Welcome to Ladies with Gumption, episode 30, Regrets. My name is Jessica, and I am here with...
May.
And Tatiana.
We are the Ladies with Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash. You can contact us on Twitter at DCTVGumption. You can send us an email, ladieswgumption@gmail.com. You can send us an ask on Tumblr, Valerie M. Perez for Tatiana, her own hero writer for May, or Falling in Love in a Flash for your favorite...
She tried to slide that in there.
Y'all know who the favorite is. We are on iTunes, and we are also on Google Play, and we are also on, we have a Facebook page. If you're on Facebook,
we're not really on it. Yeah,
I did post the last podcast, so whoever's finding it through Facebook, like, kudos.
We got you. We did get more feedback this week than last week, so thank you. Jacqueline, who is Iris Best Allen on Twitter and Tumblr, sent us an email, and she also screenshotted her review on iTunes for us, so thank you so much for that. She says that one of the highlights, the podcast is one of the highlights of her week. We're not afraid to speak our minds. Sometimes I think we should be a little more afraid.
A little more conscientious.
She said it helps her improve her English because she's from Brazil, so that. And then she also...
Your English is very good, Jacqueline.
No worries, we're not laughing at you, I promise.
No, you're laughing at me because I lost my train of thought. She wants to let May know that in the Harry Potter ad she sent to you on Tumblr, she called Ron Ronnie because that's what he's called in Portuguese version of Harry Potter. And she doesn't want you to think that she's a fake Harry Potter fan, which I thought was really cute.
It is really cute, and I didn't think that at all, Jacqueline. I got your ask, so don't worry about it.
Her main part of the email, feedback on our fan and shipping series, and she started out as a casual viewer on Netflix, and so then when she looked into the fandom post-season 2, she's kind of shocked at all the Iris hate and the fact that people thought that Snowberry was a thing. And at first, she was like, oh, you know, just ship and let ship, it's kind of funny. But when she started looking into the history and the timeline of how the ship was created, it kind of turned her off. And particularly with that fandom, she was talking about how there is like this entitlement that she thinks was encouraged a little bit by Danielle promoting it as if it was real to the fans and the media, including in front of Candace during joint interviews. And she thinks that Danielle promoting Snowberry over her canon ship, Snowstorm, is the reason why she doesn't have a decent storyline today, which kind of like when we were talking about fan and shipping last time, and I was like, you know, when the actor is supportive of their own, you know, then it's fan and shipping is a little bit more fun. And I think Jacqueline probably picked up on that. And so her email is a lot spicier than how I recapped it. I have a lot of feelings about this as well, Jacqueline, and I agree with you a lot. And I'm trying to keep my opinion as vanilla as possible. But what are you ladies think of this whole situation? Your thoughts.
I definitely agree that if Danielle had stayed, I guess, in her lane, she might have gotten more. I think my pet peeve is when actors become entitled themselves and then entitle their fandom regarding a storyline they know deep down will never happen for them, and talking about it like it's a fact. Like, to me, you, as an actor, should know your own story and your own character, and Caitlin on screen didn't want anyone but Ronnie and struggled with mourning him all throughout season 1. And on Earth 2, she was also with Ronnie and was devastated after he died. So that's what Danielle should have talked about in interviews and what she should have hyped up from the start. In the end, how can anyone root for your character when you yourself don't understand your own character and aren't really rooting for her either?
Oh, dang. I mean, I also agreed with Jacqueline's feedback with her email, and I'm, you know, also understand why we're not going to go as into it as she did. But I do think because Danielle, for whatever reason, she did think that there was a possibility there. I don't know if someone told her something or she just assumed, because it's the CW and there is love triangles. And Emily, without even meaning to, became the de facto leading lady of Arrow over the actual leading lady. So I guess she thought that that could happen for her. But like you guys said, because she advocated for things she couldn't get, she didn't spend time actually advocating from the start for things that she could get. It took her a little while to do that. And because these writers, as we know, are slow as hell, it's taken them 4 seasons to get to the stuff that we've been asking for Iris since day one. So I don't know, maybe in season 6 or 7, she'll start getting the stuff she began asking for in season 3. So we'll see. Good luck.
Yeah, I agree with you guys about her not, quote unquote, staying in her lane and promoting her actual storylines. The reason why she doesn't really have one now is, like, you know, she was, like, going off and chasing waterfalls and not sticking to the rivers and the lakes that she's used to. And now all those lakes are, like, dried up because she doesn't really have anything. Like, she cultivated her fan base around one thing that wasn't going to happen. And so there's not a lot of motivation.
That was an amazing metaphor.
Thank you. behind things that could happen, like Snowstorm and Killer Frost. And, like, what you're saying, Tatiana, like, we don't know if someone was, like, in her ear telling her something, and part of me wonders if that, if you go back to Andrew Kreisberg and the whole toxic working environment that he created, is that part of it? Because I think, again, and I've said this before, I think he just liked creating those kind of competitions within the actor's room, within the fandom, and, you know, people fighting over Barry, women fighting over Barry. And I don't, you know, and it doesn't take away from her accountability for what she did. Like, he created the swamp, but she swam in it. So obviously everything that she did, she did consciously and chose to do that, go that route. And I do wonder, like, how different, like, cast dynamics and fandom would look like if the top had created, like, a more positive environment from the start. And I don't know her. I don't think that she would have been as gung-ho about it if someone wasn't telling her, someone from the top wasn't being like, not nudge nudge wink wink, you can make this happen if you get whatever whatever.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I agree with you, because having just listened to her interview with Michael Rosenbaum, I definitely just see that she seems to be a people pleaser. Yeah. Like, that's her tendency. And, you know, I'm also kind of like that, so, like, I relate to that. So I don't think that she would go out of her way to create attention if she didn't think that it was in the works, you know?
Right. And, like, even now, I don't know if it was the most recent San Diego Comic-Con when some random reporter, you know, had to ask a Barry and Caitlin question, and she'll still answer it like it was a thing in her mind in season one that just got dropped. When, you know, it's not a thing that was actually in the narrative, but it was a thing that was in her and Andrew's head. So that, I think that's how she kind of looked at it, and she can't let that go now because she spent so much time, like, building it up. Trying to think back on when I was first joining fandom, and I remember, like, the Facebook chat that she did and how she's talking about being the only girl and her chemistry with Grant and how it's possible in interviews, how she talked about it was a possibility, and not bring up the fact that, oh, you know, oh, this is great, but right now Barry has this and I have this, and so in the future, who knows? I could be okay with that, but the fact that that's something that she didn't do, it just kept kind of, like, for me, it was like, wait, you know, wait a minute, and it was a little bit taken aback for me.
Right. I think I don't know, this is, like, a tricky subject too, because I don't want to, I feel like I already got spicy enough in my little answer, but no real ill will towards her from me. But at the same time, I feel like when she would wade in the waters of the swamp, as it were, like Jess said, that she was also disregarding her own co-star and disregarding what was actually happening in the writing. And she got those scripts, you know? So it's not like she didn't see what was obviously happening. Everyone knew, for example, Barry was in love with Iris. And even going into season two, there was another love interest brought in for Barry. So it wasn't going to be her. And I feel like by her trying to push her way towards the forefront, it also sidelined Candace, who was the leading lady. And I feel like instead of becoming an ally to her co-star, she did not do that.
We can kind of, like, blend this into the next topic, but Candace had an interview with the Nerdist in partnership with Alpha Female Fandom, or what was the name of Team Alpha podcast, where she was talking about allies and alliance. And I think, like, looking back at when she told her story in interviews about being a young actress in Hollywood, and you get this new job, and you're, like, the leading lady of the job, there's only two women on the show, and they did have, like, a more positive relationship in the beginning before the show starts, so there was something there. And then the show actually does start, and then the person that you thought that you could have a really good relationship with isn't playing by the same rules as everyone else when it comes in terms of, like, promotion and the stories. And like I said, I don't know how much of that was encouraged by Andrew, even though that doesn't really take away from the fact that it still went down the way that it went down. Yeah, it's just interesting looking 2020 vision.
Yeah, but I do love that she was talking about how she and Katie are allies. So it is nice that she in her own time, she did find a supportive community on set and off set, I guess, because now we also see her. Obviously, when Melis came, we saw that friendship and Violet and Key and now Kate on behind the scenes, too. So you can see what it's like when Candace clicks with someone versus when she does not.
What else did you like about that interview? What other kind of special tidbits that we learned?
I just like the fact that she mentioned, like, again, the allyship, but also women having each other's backs and how we are stronger together. And when we, she was saying about how when we come together and have that conversation, we can better each other and, like, together we can win the war, rather than the way society is set up to make us seem like we're very competitive, or because a lot of things are written from males' perspective and, like, for example, like TV and movies, you don't always see a lot of female friendships that feel true to reality, because I don't know, I have, quite a few close girlfriends that I hold very dear, and we're always chatting about everything, and no, it's not a big competition, and it's nice to hear her say that, and especially you can see it through Shithority and what her and Katie are really doing with the brand, and I'm hoping that it expands. And I also like that she talked about how important it is to see Barry and Iris on screen as an interracial relationship, because it's not questioned and it's very important to the narrative and all of that. So that was really nice to hear as well.
Yes, I totally agree. Especially I like how much she's been talking about Shithority and promoting it. She's really sort of taking ownership of it with Katie and also like pushing it forward. It's clearly something that they're both very passionate about, which I like to see. In addition, I like that she brought up how much she's gotten to do as Iris this season and how much she's grown. It does really feel like it's been a nice and juicy journey, I guess. And it's good that she seems happy with her storyline as an actress.
Alrighty. So we're going to move on a little bit. I think you've gotten spicy enough if you don't have heartburn already.
Yeah. That was our Flash section.
So all of the 5 DC TV shows, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, Arrow, Flash, and Black Lightning have all been renewed. So yay! The only DC TV show on the CW that's waiting to hear back from right now is iZombie, which we'll probably find out towards the end of that season whether that's going to be renewed or not. It's not my favorite season, to be honest, but I'm just not, it's kind of meh this season. Esme Bianco joins the cast of Supergirl as Lady Maxima. And I don't know a lot about Lady Maxima. Do either of you?
She's like an alien. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go first because you know something.
Yes, I do. All I do know is that she's an alien queen who is searching for her soulmate. Is it that she bewitches men, basically?
Oh. Is she an alien?
Yeah, she's
an alien queen.
Yes.
So she's searching for super-powered men for her mate. Does that mean she's going to think that Mon-El is her mate? Or John? She's like, how many are there?
That's a good point.
Oh! So, in the comics, she, I guess, has decided that Superman is supposed to be her mate. So, what if she thinks that Supergirl should be her mate instead?
Oh.
Interesting. A super twist.
A new ship will rise.
Lady girl? Super lady? Super lady.
They're super lady.
Also, in news, well, I don't know if Esme is going to be a whatever. I think she might just be a guest star.
Yeah.
But in season regular news, Jess McCallum, who plays Ava Sharp on Legends of Tomorrow, was upgraded to series regular for season 4. So, Avalanche lives on.
Woohoo!
Yeah, in case you were worried that their breakup means anything, it does not. Yay!
Can you imagine that we're like, yeah, she should leave at the beginning of the season. Now she's going to be a series regular and I'm happy about it. Like,
right. Getting into the shows, we're going to split up Legends and Black Lightning on side A. And we're still doing our mini Krypton impression. So we'll put that in our intro to side B before we talk about Arrow. Of course, same format, likes and dislikes, season predictions, and a Lady with Gumption of the Week. Oh, and Tasha our Arrow correspondent returned this week, so we'll have review for Arrow in the second half. And our host today is Tatiana. So, Tati, take it away.
It is I, Tatiana, here to give you a really shoddy recap of Legends. Killy, killy, stabby, stabby. So, Legends kicks things off with the discovery that Amaya has stolen the jump ship to rescue her village from warlords in 1992. But the whole team can't go after her because Grodd wants to kill Obama in his college years. So, Nate and Wally go to Zambezi to use the power of love on Amaya and ensure that Malice can escape from his prison. Zari stays on the Wave Rider to hunt for loopholes because she's had too much screen time lately. And Sarah, Ray, and Mick head to Occidental College to spout excellent puns like Run, Barry, Run and Make America Grodd Again. Malice's cage, meanwhile, is cracking right through Nora's face. But Grodd gets shrunk and stuck in a jar, which prevents him from breaking Malice out entirely. Which is a good thing in Damien's book, because he's decided he would rather not lose his daughter for the sake of world domination after all. Nora, however, seems perfectly fine with her imminent demise. So, Damien pretends like he's off to find Grodd, when instead, he's off to find the Legends. He brings the Legends the water totem as an olive branch, but Sarah needs a little bit more convincing than that. So she has a heart-to-heart with Barack Obama, who suggests that this is a delicate mission requiring a wacky dose of legendary behavior. So, Sarah decides she'll take Damien on for now, as long as she can kill him later. Great. But how are they going to get Nora to comply when she's so obsessed with Mollus? Luckily for them, Mollus sounds just like John Noble. So Ray pretends to be a PA, if only it were that easy, to get on the set of Lord of the Rings and trick John Noble into saying a bunch of stuff Mollus would say so that then Ray can play it in Nora's ear and make her think that her god is speaking to her, basically. Once she's on the Wave Rider with them, Damien traps her with his magic and gives her the apology of a lifetime. But unfortunately, Mollus has already taken over and tells him Nora's pretty much dead. So then Damien has a heart-to-heart with Sarah, apologizes for killing Laurel, and commends her for taking on the Death Totem and winning. Which somehow leads to Sarah giving Damien the Death Totem, even though she's the only one who's overcome it. Hello? I don't know. Not the best decision. Anyway, over in Zambezi, Amaya isn't listening to Wally, and Nate isn't even listening to himself, because he loves Amaya too much to give a fuck about Flashpoint. The issue at hand is that her daughter Essie won't accept the Anansi totem, which leaves Zambezi vulnerable to attack the very next day. And for some reason, Amaya is just too old to use it, and young Amaya can't use it. I don't know. I don't know why. It has to be Essie who uses it. So, young Amaya shares some of her doubts with Essie and bonds with her, inspiring her to be more like her mother and take on the totem just in the nick of time. While Nate is busy trying to steal the totem from older Amaya so that he can protect the village if Essie fails, she wakes up and then he has to use his phone as proof that they were once lovers, because old Amaya actually erased her own memory so that she could leave Nate behind and make babies with some other dude that we have not met yet. Back on the Wave Rider, Zari cannot find a loophole, so Sarah says fuck it and just decides to let Mollus escape so they can fight him with all six of their totems, even though that's what the totem bearers did before, and that failed. Ava thinks that that is a horrible plan, and so she leaves after rejecting Sarah's I love you. But she only rejected it because she feels bad that Rip told her that she's the 12th Ava that he's had in the Bureau because he is a stupid shit who cannot lead anything. Anyway, the Legends split up the totems in order to fight Mollus while Essie prepares to defend Zambezi from warlords and also Grodd, because Damien spoke to Nora while holding the Death Totem, so Death Totem Nora told him she doesn't want to die, and he can still save her. Even though it's wrong, because no one told Damien that that's how the Death Totem works. But anyway, Grodd tries to destroy Zambezi. The Legends defend it. Mollus breaks free. Sarah stabs Damien in the back. An ugly-ass dragon demon thing emerges from Nora's carcass. The end. That's what you missed on Legends. You can obviously tell some of my feelings on the episode, but before, let me ask you guys your feelings on the episode. Share what you love best.
The plot moved. And it was all tying together. What I liked about the penultimate episode is that it moved so quickly, but most of the characters got to shine in their own ways. The one who didn't will be mentioned later. This whole, I feel like this whole season has been building up to revisiting Amaya's future and seeing the village we've heard so much about finally make an appearance, and that was great. Seeing old Amaya, little Kuasa, and meeting her daughter Essie for the first time really made the stakes feel higher. And because how can you see them and let their village be slaughtered and be okay with it, right? It gave the story, you know, more time to be invested on a human level. And speaking of investment on a human level, I find that I've never cared more for Dark than I did during this episode. He's still evil, but at least there were human reasons for his actions rather than the usual, I just want to destroy the world because I'm bored, which is like the kind of villain he's always felt like. Sarah getting to show how far she's come in terms of her relationship with Dark was really great too. She was letting him give her advice and actually took it and weirdly trusted him with the death totem because she trusted him more than she trusted herself, which is weird, but you know, I guess that means she was really affected by it. I also like that she kept trying to fight for Ava and told her she loved her because she really felt it and also believed it would help Ava to realize that she wasn't just a clone. And I think it was a really sweet and believable moment. I like that Wally got to talk about his own knowledge of what happens when you time travel and try to change a major event. And I like that he never gave that up, and his exasperation when Nate wouldn't listen to him was hilarious. And that bromance is definitely alive, right? He's like, I love you, Nate, and fandom exploded. I love the John Noble bit, and when Ray said that the studio requested more female characters in Lord of the Rings, I died. His lines being inside Nora and his immediate not like that when Damien made, you know, kept making faces at him were really funny. And then when Sarah said she missed Obama, all I could say was like, same, girl, same. And I thought it was really clever that in the same episode they were talking about Flashpoint, Ray says, run, Barry, run to Obama. And he's like, please call me Barry. I like Barack. Stick with that. And the actor who played Obama was super good. Like, his voice, you know, and the way he kind of moved his body language and all that stuff was really good. And he was so sincere offering his advice to Sarah and not being at all disturbed for whatever reason about what she was talking about.
Like the gorilla.
He could handle it all.
And I also like the moment when younger Amaya bonds with Essie, and it turns out that they have the same sense of spirit and also the same doubts. God actually felt threatening, and so did Mollus. And finally, I actually thought that Nate was really sweet to Amaya this episode, both to older her and younger her, and I was impressed and surprised because he's gone on my nerves the last few episodes. And I do like that he seems to really understand how important this is to Amaya and that he helps her save her village the best he can, damn all the consequences, you know? And I especially like that he told her she wasn't selfish when she admitted she knows what she's doing is selfish in her eyes, which is a step up from that stupid article that I won't talk about.
Oh!
You're a little
internet. All
right. You do not give free press, so, you know.
Yeah.
Figure it out, girl. Let me just say off the bat, I'm going to agree with you. The actor that they chose to play young Barry, young Barack, was like a million times better than the actor they chose to play young Elvis. Just, he sounded like him, and like you're saying, like, the body language and everything. And personally, I just think they wrote an entire episode around Barack Obama so they could make the political puns and have and Barry run, because he really didn't factor that much at all into the main plot. Like, I feel like when we heard about it, they made like a big deal about, we're looking for a young Barack Obama, but then he was in like one or two scenes. But I do like that he also got that scene with Sarah, and I think Katie liked that a lot as well, because you could just she was just really happy in that scene. So, and you, like you say, he gave like nice advice, and like, he was so like chill about the ridiculousness of the situation. So it was just a nice little way to include him into an episode that really wasn't about him. I also thought that the John Noble cameo was really excellent and really well played. It was a nice workaround and kind of a tongue-in-cheek storyline to have them notice that the demon sounded exactly like John Noble, who plays Mollus. So it's kind of like a wink and a nod kind of thing. And then send Ray to the production as a production extra to record him saying the lines. And I remember asking Tati when I was like watching the episode, I was like, Tati, what's the name of the episode? And she's like, guest starring John Noble. And I was almost like, I know you did it. What's the name of the episode? And I was like, oh, that is the name of the episode. was confusing and funny. Like you were saying about Wally, at one point I just laughed and he was making the exasperated face at Nate and Maya. Because he just had a funny face and just made me laugh. Oh, I, a known Ava Sharp stan, continue to be moved by her. And in this episode, what I liked and later didn't like was her conversation with Rip. And my dislikes, I'll get into that later. But the thing that I liked about it is that she kept pressing him for answers. She made him be, like, accountable for what he did. And I thought it was good for her because it gave her command of her story and made her situation from last week a little bit less of a plot point and more of a development for her, which was nice. And considering that she's going to be a regular on season 4, I thought it was a good moment, a jumping point off for her. Similarly, Fod and the people that I never thought I like, I was also moved by Damien Dark and his tragedy in the episode. I thought he still continues to provide a lot of really comedic moments, as well as the emotional scenes with Nora. I really felt for him when he thought that he lost his daughter. I thought he was coming from a genuine place when he said he wanted to help the Legends. And to be honest, it's completely understandable why he turned on him in the end, because he thought that he could save his daughter. So I wasn't really even mad that he betrayed them, because I believe they're coming from a place of love for his daughter, even if it comes at the cost of the fate of the world. And that's kind of like, you know, as a parent, I would want my dad to, like, save me over the world, you know? You know, I can't fault him for that. And Anna Mai is basically doing the same thing. She's just like, fuck it, fuck the world for my family. So it's the same difference. Courtney Ford did an excellent job this episode as Mollus Nora. I thought that her possession and everything was, like, really well acted for her. So kudos to Courtney. And the Mollus actual demon reveal at the end of the episode is great. And I thought he was sufficiently terrifying. Overall, I think it was a pretty good episode.
I agree. I really liked that the plot moved forward, like May said earlier. It's been dragging its feet with the Mollus plot all season. And it was really noticeable in the last few episodes. So this week, it was like 5 episodes worth of plot jammed into one, preparing us for what is clearly going to be a high-stakes, epic season finale. And it felt like it was a lot of fun to watch. And it was like a lot of information and a lot of action, but it didn't feel overwhelming or it didn't feel like too jumbled up. So that was good. I also agree that I really felt for Damien this episode. He, you know, the idea of losing his daughter for good and of his own doing, right? He did this to her. It's finally really hitting him. And I liked how it paralleled Amaya's story, like Jessica just pointed out, like that they are both, although, you know, Amaya is not evil, so she's not the reason that Zambezi falls. But the idea that sometimes you sacrifice, you know, either your ambitions or the greater good. Because in a way, like, Damien's true love has always been world domination and murdering randos. But then he had a child, he had Nora, and now those priorities have changed, right? He would give up world domination for Nora, even though he just wanted it to give to her, as he said, right? He's like, what's the point of world domination if I don't have my daughter to give it to? So there's that. And then Amaya, obviously, is sacrificing, you know, she sacrifices her relationship with Nate to go back to Zambezi, but she's also sacrificing what she always has fought for, right? Which is, like, justice for all or the greater good to save the people that she loves in Zambezi. So, yeah, I think it's really cool. And I liked that the Legends were so quick to be on Amaya's side, right? I have an issue with it because of previous episodes, but in this episode I liked it a lot, that it was like, oh, Amaya's gonna go save her peeps? Okay, well, we'll figure out how to make that work for us. That was great. I also, I thought it was cool that Sarah then realized, like, hey, why don't we use that to our advantage? And I loved how they incorporated Barack, even though I totally agree that someone just wanted to make those puns. The best ones were Make America Broad Again and Run Barry, for sure. Although I did like, underrated, but I did like when Sarah said Obamacare, like, it's time for some Obamacare. Also, her wiping his memory every time, like, made me giggle. I was like, oh, okay, that's why things haven't changed for us, because Barack Obama did not know about the Legends. Otherwise, we could be in a totally different situation now. But anyway, the actor was great. he really, like, it reminded me of, I don't know if you guys saw that movie, I can't remember what it's called, South Side with You, maybe?
Yeah.
I was like, because I remember, like, watching that, and like, oh, it's cool, like, you know, seeing an actor, like, try to imitate Barack's mannerisms, and this dude did a pretty good job of it. I don't know his name, but you go, dude. Go be an Obama impersonator somewhere. Anyway, and yeah, just like Sarah, I miss Barry, too. Hopefully, I won't have to miss him as much in the near future. Anyway, Nora and Dark's farewell scene was really affecting, like, from both sides of it, too, like, because she reminds him that he's not going to be seeing her again, right? She'll see Mollus next time, or he'll see Mollus next time, and it's like she is asking him to say goodbye to her before he goes, right? Yeah. So that was, I was like, oh, that's so sad. And then the death totem scene when he was talking to her, and she was like, I don't really want to die. Save me. And I was like, oh, I'm going to cry. So yeah, like, I mean, if I were stupid enough to hold the death totem when I went to go talk to my daughter, I too would have done what Damien did. But anyway, like, it's just Mollus manipulating him, but it was still a really good scene. And yes, Courtney Ford did a great job. Someone said to me that they didn't like her acting, him or who, and I was like, gasp, I'm offended on her behalf. But anyway.
They didn't like her in this episode?
No, just in general, that they don't like her acting. And I was like, what's she done to you? But anyway, I don't remember who it was, I don't remember the context.
Say that. God.
Yeah, exactly. I will fight you. Okay, so Wally was trying to get someone, anyone at all, to listen to him about Flashpoint and the consequences of time travel were hilarious to me and adorable, both on, like, in the episode it makes sense because Nate loves Amaya too much to not help, and obviously Amaya is gonna say fuck it because it's her family, just like Barry said fuck it because it was his family. But from the outside, it was also kind of funny, like a metatextual level, because Legends is a show where they fuck with time every week. Even though they're supposed to protect time, they're the ones who break it. Every season starts with, time is broken worse than before. And so now we have to, because of us, and now we have to fix it again. So it's kind of like, whatever. Like, she has to do this so that they have another season, right?
But it's like in your own little bubble, right? Because does it even affect anybody else on the other shows?
Exactly. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't even affect them. Like, sometimes they get an extra daughter, and that's it.
They fixed it, that's why it doesn't affect anybody else.
So yeah. That was fun on a meta level for me. I thought it was great to see how far Nate has come, like, because he started off the show being like an annoying little jit. So he started off being like just, you know, our least favorite character, basically. And not deserving of Amaya's love, in our opinion. And now he has finally become the man, a man that deserves to be with Amaya, but to do that, he has to be the one that's gonna let her go, you know? So he can't be with her, and whatever. It was great. Definitely the most that I've liked them as a couple and him as a character. I also loved her conversation with Essie. I thought it was really sweet to see her connecting with her daughter and helping her embrace the idea of a totem, as well as to accept her own death. It was great. And Sarah telling Ava that she loves her was a beautiful scene also. I thought it was really, like, you know, she really thought that she could get through to her. Oh, well. So yes, it was. It broke my heart in a good way.
Now that you mention it, when you put it that way about Nate, now I feel bad for the bastard.
What did we not like so much about the episode?
Well, like, speaking of, like, Nate and Amaya, I have to get off that right now. Essie definitely has two black parents. So, Nate, you are not the father. It's funny because... that we were most sure about this entire season is the one that we got the most completely wrong. Like, Kwasa, sweetie, I'm so sorry. I thought Nate was your grandfather.
Yep, boo on us.
Yeah. But, like, this really isn't, like, a dislike, other than that I don't like how it's wrong. But it also, I feel like, kind of diminishes the Steel Vixen love story a little bit, for me at least. Like, the whole idea about true love and fate and destiny and the whole tragedy of it would, in my opinion, be better played if the fate that they thought that they were fighting for, or they're trying to be together and deny fate, was actually what their destiny was the whole time, and they could be together and live happily ever after, but that's not what happened. And then the fact that her having to go back and erase her memory of her true love just so she could make sure that two specific people were born in the future, it just sounds kind of like depressing almost, because we never get to see who her new man is, that's Essie's father. It's not that she goes back and she's sad, but then she finds new love and she's still able to have a good life. I don't know. It just felt like very sad for her, more tragic for her, that she had to erase her memory just so these two specific people could be born rather than having happiness and finding true love for herself. So I didn't like that. Speaking of depressing breakups, I too was happy about Sarah saying the I love you to Ava, but I don't like that because of her conversation with Rip, that she responds that there is no me to love. Like, I felt attacked, personally. And I was like, it's kind of crazy because I didn't even want to be on this boat in the first place. So now that I'm here, and then she says I love you, and then, you know, Ava just doesn't feel like she's lovable. It's just, like, it hurts, and I don't like it. I don't like Rip for telling Ava that she was basically the perfect agent because she was replaceable. Every time you see him, like, every season, whenever he brings in someone to the Legends, it's always because of some kind of selfish reason, and he just, whatever. Okay, it sucks. Something else I felt for, surprisingly, was, again, I really felt for Damien, but I still thought it was stupid that Sarah trusted him with the death totem. Like, the prophecy clearly said that the Zambezi tribes were betrayed by the death totem, so instead of Sarah, who has willed the death totem and overcome it, let's give it to this powerful, only newly sort of redeemed villain and see what he does. Like, it really made no sense. And even though he lost his daughter, he's still Damien Dark. I thought it was a stretch for them to think that he wouldn't betray them. And it worked out great story-wise for Damien because he betrayed them for the right reason, for saving his daughter. But it just made Legends look stupid. So, like, as soon as they gave it to him, like, well, yep, there he goes. Now the Death Totem is going to do what the Death Totem does and betray them once again. I like that Zari wanted to help her totally not girlfriend Maya because she's totally not in love with her. You know, even though, like, they are, like, the best together. But anyway, I didn't like that she had to be off screen for most of the episode to help her girlfriend. I'm a little sad that the Water Totem didn't work for Ray. I wanted him to have something and for it to work because I think he deserves good things. And, like, Macy's old person makeup was just awful. I saw a gift set on Tumblr with her mom, who plays the ancestor, and, like, the ancestor, like, Maisie looks like her ancestor's ancestor. Like, that's how old she looks. And Effie is, like, has to be in maybe her early 30s, I want to say. And so I feel like Amaya should have been, like, in her mid-60s or so, but she looked like she was in her 80s, and I feel like no one in that makeup department clearly got the memo that black don't crack, because her face was just, like, cracked all the way up, and it was just not believable.
Yeah, I agree. I think the makeup was overdone. Like, in trying to make her look older, they went too far into the
future. They went way too far.
Tati will get more into this, but I remember back in the day when everyone was mad at Barry for Flashpoint, and that included the Legends, and no one can let go of that for whatever reason, but they're still, like, okay with doing the exact same thing. I think this show has stopped making rules about time travel and just does whatever, so I was a little bit frustrated that everyone disregarded Wally about time, since they're supposed to be its keepers or whatever. I don't understand also why Amaya had to, well, I understand, but to me it basically said that she was so desperate to preserve her future that she couldn't move on from her past in a healthy way. And I know it was supposed to play out like this romantic thing, like, oh, she couldn't move on from Nate, so she decided to erase him instead because that's how powerful their love is, but it didn't feel that way. It felt like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and they were just trying to zap the memory from your head because it just hurt too much. And I must have missed something, because I don't understand how she ended up remembering him in the end. Did I miss something? I don't know.
No, she got knocked on her head. You know how they do, like, you get knocked on your head and suddenly, oh, I remember. I don't have amnesia anymore.
Yes. So that's what happened, and it confused me for a bit. And I agree with Jess in that making Nate not be the baby daddy means that Steel Vixen ship is reduced in the eyes of the writers. And that is not to say that I am upset that Nate is not the baby daddy, even though, like you said, it was the one theory we were all going for. It didn't happen. So I do wonder, like, what they're going to do with it moving into the future and into next season. I disliked the fact that Mick didn't do anything all episode. Like, what was the point of him having the fire totem if he wasn't going to use the fire totem? He ended up using his heat gun, which was stupid because he has a fire totem. So, like, they may as well have given the totem to Wally, since Mick is a waste of space at this point. And while I was really happy, I was really happy that Sarah was able to tell Ava that she loved her. I dislike the fact, like just said, that Ava said that there's nothing for her to love. That cut me deep in my emotions, too. And Sarah trusting Damien so quickly didn't make a whole lot of sense, other than the plot needed it to be that way. I also didn't see the point of Rip, other than to have him be questioned by Ava, but him as a character no longer feels like he belongs in general, so his presence doesn't have the weight that it used to have.
I agree with almost everything that y'all are saying. And, yes, I loved Wally telling the legend about Flashpoint, but like May pointed out, them ignoring it makes me a little salty as a Flash fan and, like, just a viewer who enjoys time travel that makes sense. Because Legends plays very much fast and loose with the rules of time travel. And even within their own show, they changed their minds. Like, all season long, Amaya could not change what happened to Zambezi, right? She, like, had to go back to Zambezi because she had to have these kids. Well, this kid to have those kids. But she also could not save them because changing time is bad. And that's also why Sarah can't save Laurel, right? It's been two seasons now that Sarah has to, like, physically prevent herself from saving Laurel. But then when Amaya actually does it, they're like, yeah, fine. Okay. Break time. It'll be awesome. So yeah, like I said, I think it's funny. And that was in my life. So I think it's funny because every season times we broke worse than ever before because we did that. But I don't like that it doesn't mean anything. Whereas on The Flash, they literally had an entire season about the consequences of Flashpoint. And Barry was everyone's worst villain because of it. But on Legends, it's just cute and fun, and they're the best DC TV heroes because they just don't take anything seriously, and they create their own anachronisms so that we can laugh when Napoleon is doing disco or whatever. I can't remember what it was now. Who was doing disco? Was it Napoleon? Did I make that up?
Anyway. I don't remember.
We'll say it was.
So, yeah. So, anyway, they're really bad at their jobs, and I wish this was acknowledged more often. Okay. Moving on. Nate not being Amaya's baby daddy is fine, except I agree that it's creepy as fuck that she has to literally wipe her own memory in order to become the perfect vessel to birth Essie. And right now it could, like, be artificial insemination for all we know, because we don't know who the fuck this person is that she had babies with. He's either dead, I don't know what he's doing. Like, it would have been nice to see a little bit, like, if there was an episode that was, what happens to Amaya when she goes back to Zambezi, you know? And we got to see, like, what makes her decide that, or, like, falling in love with, you know, that person, whoever he is. Because if she wiped her own memory, then maybe, I don't know, maybe she does fall for that person. And isn't just like, well, I guess I have to do this. And how much does she wipe? Like, can you remember that you have to have these kids, and you learn this? I keep saying these kids, I mean this kid, while you were on the Wave Rider, but then you just delete the Nate part of it? Like, there's these cool people, and then this one blob that I can't make out, and I don't really know what that blob was doing.
No, but she couldn't remember the legends either.
Yeah, so how did she, so she must have actually, it must have been natural, right? She must have gone back and then just naturally done that. But if she was so concerned, I don't know.
I mean, it doesn't make sense because only they haven't really explained how the, you know, Men in Black zappy thingy works, since they don't specify, like, how far back they can zap. Can you only zap certain instances of your memory? Because otherwise she would have just zapped her entire life.
What did they really rock when she, like, because Sarah zapped him twice, so.
Yeah.
How much was he affected?
I don't know. The zap thing is, you know, it's just one of those magical plot devices that doesn't actually make sense. So, it's creepy. Moving on. I thought that the legends had a lot of great bits this episode. But Zari was underused, for one, which doesn't matter so much because she has had great arcs over the course of the season. Mick, though, has not done shit all season, as has already been mentioned, and it's literally only one episode left, and he doesn't even want to be there. He does not act like he cares about saving the world at all, or about changing time, or anything. Like, he's literally there because he's a bum, I guess, and he doesn't have somewhere else to go. So, it's time to let him go. Let Mick go. Let him be free. I'm tired of him. And I get that Damian and the Darks wanted Grodd there. And I get that Legends, like the show, wanted to use Grodd because they can. But I don't understand his purpose as a villain at all in this episode. Like, why is he doing what he's doing? You know, like, why would he want to kill Barak? How is that going to help him take over the world? How does that make America Grodd again? Was he going to become president instead of Trump? Like, I don't get it. I get that Damien's the one that sent him, but what did Damien say to him? What does Damien have on him? Is Damien magically mind-controlling him? Same with Zambezi. Like, Damien just released him, and now he's in Zambezi attacking this random African village? Was he just like, yeah, that makes sense? Because before, he's always been a planner. He's always been, he's a genius gorilla, right? So he's either out for specific revenge for people that hurt him, or he was plotting to put all of fucking Vietnam under his control, right? And now he's just like, I'm gonna kill Barack Obama. I'm gonna destroy this village. Like, it's not his MO at all. That was a worse character assassination than Wally West. That's all.
Grodd deserves better.
Grodd deserves better. And like I said in my, recap, yeah, Damien's actions make sense emotionally speaking, but what led to those actions feels like a little bit of plot over character, right? Like, why would Sarah be so unsure of herself that she decides to give it over to Damien, right? Like, why does she think that her love of her team wouldn't prevent her from betraying them more than his love of his daughter? And why wouldn't they have told him, hey, by the way, the death totem gives you hallucinations of dead people that you love, so maybe don't put it on yet until it's time to fight. Don't hold it or whatever.
The death,
you know,
totem is kind of confusing though, right? Because he's like, how can I be seeing you? You're not dead.
Mm-hmm.
But then we saw that Wally didn't see a dead person either. I don't know. It just makes sense.
But yeah. Like, it's iffy because it's like, well, I guess Jesse's dead to him. The relationship is dead. That's why he's dead with it. But that's also, you know, a problem with that episode, that they used Jesse instead of using Francine.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just wanted to use Jesse. So yeah, so this is like, they just wanted Dark to betray them. So this is how they had to get there. And even though everyone collectively thinks that Sarah is making a dumb choice, no one actually stands up to her or actually, you know, tries to, like, take over leadership for the day. And Ava just leaves. She's like, well, this is stupid. I'm out. So anyway, that's it. I'm done now. So do we have predictions for the finale and or season 4, which we're having?
I think my only prediction, well, I predict that Mick will leave, but it is also a hope. And if he doesn't, I will be annoyed because he has become super annoying and useless to the plot. To the team in general, as a human being, he is disrespectful and he's become uncaring and he has no feelings whatsoever and he needs to go.
The end.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately the water totem didn't work for Ray, but will it work for his female equivalent, Ava? She's like female Ray, right? So I wonder if she'll be able to wield the water totem, and if she can, will that, like, kind of help make her feel special? Because right now she doesn't really feel special. She doesn't really feel like she is anything other than, like, a carbon copy. So, like, maybe if the water totem chooses her, then she'll be able to choose herself.
Oh, I like that theory a lot. I hope it happens. Because yeah, I think that Ava should be important to the proceedings in the finale. And we need 6 totems if we want a shot at defeating Malus. So fingers crossed that that happens.
Just someone needs to take the totem from Mick. That's fine. Ray can have the fire totem.
Jax is coming back, so.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's right. He might wield it. I forgot about that. But do you think he's... He's probably just cleaning up for the episode, though, right? Probably not permanently.
Yeah. I don't know if he's permanently, but I feel like the reason that he left was because he couldn't be Firestorm. So if you give him a fire totem...
Oh, shit! I love it. Okay, I love it. I love it. That's great. That's great. I mean, that's a great prediction. Okay, so Jax will get Jax will get Mick's fire totem, and Ava will get Ray's water totem. And then they will defeat Malus, and then season 4 is going to be fixing the anachronisms from Amaya saving Zambezi.
I agree with you.
If she saves Zambezi, will she still be able, because there's would she still be able to technically be a legend?
That's the question. She might, I guess she could, I guess she might be gone after to go back to Zambezi, because eventually she's going to have to start her life there, right? Because what's the point of, if she saves Zambezi, but then she never goes back to Zambezi, then Zambezi can't be saved.
Weird time travel rules, change
they will they will bend the rules for her. Technically speaking, I guess she can drop in whenever she feels like it, because time wouldn't have moved at all if she just returns to 1942. But
except, remember, the Wave Rider is stupid and they don't know how to use it, because they couldn't even make it to they had to like book it to make it to Lily's labor, even though they shouldn't have to book it because they are not in time. But anyway. Anyway. Shall we proceed on to Black Lightning?
Yes.
We shall.
All right. Black Lightning. So, Black Lightning gives us the post-Easter crucifixion and resurrection of Freeland's Black Jesus this week. VP Cara Foudy, a.k.a. his Judas, has Deputy Chef Kamen plant green light on Jefferson and arrest him in front of all of his disciples at Garfield High. The students all know it's a setup, and some try to stand up for Jefferson, including his daughters, of course, but he must calm them all down because he doesn't want to see anyone else get arrested or worse. The keep calm motto resonates especially with Jennifer, who tries her best to be strong for her mother Lynn, but eventually has a mini breakdown and needs some comfort, some motherly comfort. Meanwhile, Inspector Henderson is also suspicious of Jefferson's arrest, and even goes so far as to ask for the receipts before reluctantly accepting there's nothing he can do for the moment. But he knows Kamen is dirty, given that he's got photographic evidence of arms deals done with the ASA, so he just keeps his eyes peeled for now. The cops, of course, are absolute chits while processing Jefferson and after, treating him brusquely, humiliating him whenever possible, in a way that isn't even personal. It's just how awful they are to prisoners all the time. Anissa would just breathe deep in everyone's face until Jefferson is free. But Gambi has a better plan. He devises a hologram of Black Lightning for Anissa to draw attention to, thus making everyone believe that Black Lightning is out on these streets while Jefferson is in the jail cell. Henderson leverages an underling's crimes to oust Kamen, free Jefferson, and become Freeland PD's new captain. Meanwhile, Gambi is not totally forgiven for his crimes, but at least he's welcome to family dinner. And that's what you missed on Black Lightning.
By the way, I love the Easter Black Jesus analogy. I thought that was great.
Thank you. Thank you. I felt bad about the Legends recap, so I was like, it's fucking short. So here we go. What did you ladies like about this episode?
I thought this was a really good episode for Black Lightning. It was like very intense the whole way through, and the suspense carried through all the way to the end, such that I didn't even know. I know he's the hero of the story, but I was still a little bit worried that he was not going to get out of jail in time, that the ASA was actually going to get him. So I liked that there was that suspense that carried all the way through and had you really invested about how is he going to get out of this. I liked that it brought two previously minor characters more into the forefront, so Foudy and Henderson, and fleshed out both of their stories to have a bigger impact moving forward, because we really hadn't seen a lot from either of them, and they kind of stepped up in a major way in this episode, and so I liked that we got to get more of their backstory and kind of flesh them out and make them more 3D. Every single character had great moments and great scenes related to one single storyline. Like, this was a whole thing was around Jefferson's arrest, and every pair of characters on the side, whether they're in the Pierce family or minor characters, all had lines that related back to this one central storyline, which I thought was really good. And it worked in this episode. Like, we didn't see Lala, or we still don't know where Tobias is, but I think they would have been superfluous in this episode. So I kind of like that it was all centered around this one event. I really enjoyed the Anissa and Gambi dynamic, because I felt like it's a really sweet grandfather-daughter bond that brings Gambi closer into the Pierce family fold. I, too, and Tatiana will talk about this later, but I, when he, she wrote her notes before me, she's like, yes, I agree. But, like, when Gammy came up with the idea of using, like, the hologram for Holobad, Black Lightning, I thought that it reminded me of when, in The Flash, they use the hologram for Barry when he didn't have a speed, but they wanted to make sure that people still thought The Flash was running around. So I thought that was really good. And I like on this is Thunderclap. So this is a new move that she kind of learned. We didn't get to see her learn it, but I kind of like that we keep seeing her coming up with these new moves and incorporating them without necessarily having it be like a thing that, oh, I have to, because like on The Flash it gets a little annoying where he's like, oh, you have to do da 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 da, I don't think I can do it, and then he like does it and then it's like a move that he's learned and then he never uses it again because it was just very wonderful. So I like that with her it's kind of a natural kind of thing where you keep seeing new things that she's learning how to do and it's being incorporated in what feels like a natural way. The arrest scene for Jefferson was really, it was really aggravating because you know that he's innocent, you know these cops are dirty, but it was just so well done again. Like the actual morning of the arrest, it's super bright outside, it's very sunny, Jefferson's happy, the girls are happy, everyone's happy, happy, happy. And then because you know it's coming, like the ugliness, it was like a stark contrast between what you knew was about to happen. So I thought that was really well done. The keep calm that he was telling everyone, to himself, to Jennifer, to Tavon, and the rest of the students, and then to Nyssa, and all the scenes of him struggling to remain calm. I thought Chris Williams did just acting his ass off, and it was amazing, and it was really powerful. And I also, like, and at the end, that it wasn't even Nyssa and Gambi's super heroics that saved the day. It was actually Henderson being a good cop and doing his duty and getting justice for Jefferson, even though Jefferson won't tell him that he's Black Lightning. But I like that his police work is what actually freed Jefferson, because it tied back to Lynn telling Jennifer, you know, when she's like, why can't he just Black Lightning himself out? And she's like, well, you can't punch or superpower your way out of every problem. And that kind of felt like it tied into why Henderson was the one to get Jefferson out and not Nyssa and Gambi running around with their Black Lightning hologram. So
I agree with pretty much everything.
I'm shocked.
Yes.
I wonder how short these would be if we just said the stuff that hadn't already been said. We could have a 30-minute podcast.
But then everyone will stop listening to us because I hope they enjoy our long.
I hope so too.
I especially like the show dealt with false imprisonment and the experience of going to jail and have the cops treat inmates in a realistic way. And the scene with the officer asking Jefferson to take off his clothes was really powerful, and that it stayed with me long after the episode ended. I liked Gambi and Anissa's dynamic as well. And I feel part of the reason Jefferson was okay with allowing him back into the fold was because of her. And I like that even though Shady Fowdy was indeed up to shady things, she was not 100% willing to believe that Jefferson was Black Lightning. And even if she did, I think she still didn't like seeing him mistreated the way that he was. And maybe she'll decide to switch sides in the end. We shall see. I guess that's my prediction. I loved Jennifer and Lynn's conversation and how vulnerable Jennifer was. I think I saw China and McClane joke on Instagram that she's been crying for like the last 3 episodes.
True.
But I like that you can see each event happening around her, bringing her closer and closer to her becoming a superhero herself, especially when these things are hitting so close to her family. And I like that Lynn is always the level-headed one and says that not, you know, every problem can be fixed with powers. It just felt really realistic and true to the way that she sees reality versus like the superheroics that Jefferson and Anissa are caught up in. And I really like that Henderson was incorporated more into the plot as well, and that he risked his own life to try to get Jefferson freed, even though he knew Jefferson wasn't telling him the whole truth. And I especially like that he was able to take down Clayton as well, kind of like proof that not all cops are crooked, but the crooked make it harder to do the job that good guys like Henderson want to do. I also like the sisterly teasing, you know, back and forth was really nice, because I always need more of that in my life. And finally, I really like that Jefferson was once again shown as an everyday hero and that his students appreciate him so much. And I agree that Cress Williams did so well in this episode to portray so many aspects of Jefferson's emotions, but watching him trying to keep everyone calm while he himself wasn't calm on the inside showed a tremendous amount of restraint and control, and it was really well done.
In a twist, I also agree with everything that all y'all said. But especially Cress Williams did give an incredible performance. And as the episode itself was really strong. Like, obviously, every week, Black Lightning is good TV. But this is probably my favorite episode since the first half of the season. Because it's just been, I was just really, like, emotionally powerful and really centered around one theme. Like Jessica already pointed out, like everything is going back to the plot of Jefferson being arrested. And it's one of those sort of, it's not really standalone, but it feels like it could be standalone because it's literally like he gets arrested in that episode and then he's released in that episode, you know, and the ASA didn't really move forward aside from just like, oh, I guess he's not Black Lightning after all, which would have been their thoughts 5 minutes before the end of the previous episode. So my point is, it's basically like Enter Flash Time. Just that it was that's how good it was for me in comparison to the rest of Black Lightning, which is already really good. So I loved the students all knowing it was a setup immediately and trying to protect or defend Jefferson. And like you said, him having to calm them down when he's like, you know, he has to be so angry at his own mistreatment. And it reminds me of the first episode, which I was going to call the pilot, but it's not a pilot. It's actually just the first episode. So the first episode, when he was stopped by the cop and you see his eyes sort of, you know, like the lightning, like he wants to act out, but he has to control himself. And so now it's like he's come so far that he's like stopping Jennifer from from her little lightning happening. So yeah, I really enjoyed that. And I enjoyed how the students' reactions prove what a icon or like what a mentor Jefferson is for the community. Just like that video of everyone talking about, you know, basically what Jefferson means to me, or like why they don't believe that he did it. And then the one white person being like, they call him Black Jesus. This is so offensive. So anyway, so yeah, which was apropos, right? It's always just that one white person ruining everything, or 51%. But anyway. It's almost a shame that Jefferson and Black Lightning are the same person, because it's nice to think that there's two people doing so much good for the community. But nope, it's just the one. I loved how Jennifer took his words to heart about being strong, and she really tried to hold it together, tried to be there for her mom. And also, Chyna is just such a compelling actress. Like, she and Cress, and Christine too, like, there's just so many strong actors, but she's been impressing me consistently over the last few weeks. So I cannot wait for her time to shine and for her to really get her own, like, overarching plot so we can see her act her ass off all the time. Also, I loved Lynn's advice to her and, you know, her thesis, which was proven correct when Henderson got Jefferson out. But I also loved the moment where she goes, you know, to the center, to the jail, to try to see Jefferson, or, you know, she gives them her ID, like, they ask for her ID, which he says she's his wife, and then she has to be like, oh, actually, I'm his ex-wife. And they're like, oh, well, I guess you're not family then, are you? And I was like, this is why they're not together, just for that moment. She can't get in by saying she's his wife. So, and also the fact that she said that she was his wife, because she still sees herself as his wife, because they should just be fucking together. Fucking and
thank
together.
You.
So.
Okay.
Anyway, yes, it was great to see Foudy and Henderson step up as characters, even though Foudy obviously sucks, and Henderson does not suck, but there was a long stretch of time where I was like, what is the purpose of Henderson? Why is he really here? And now, you know, he has fulfilled his purpose, now he's cool, I like you, and it is great to see, like, because so much of the story is anti-police propaganda, if you will, right? Like, everything is police propaganda in the sense that, like, oh, the police are good and they're gonna help you and they're, you know, it's, you have to be on the side of the law. But Black Lightning shows the other side of things, which is the police are often corrupt and so you have to sometimes be on your own. But like you guys already said, Henderson does show that it's the system that's broken and not all individual people, right? And so sometimes it's nice to see the individual get a win over the corrupt system from within the system, even though other things that we will talk about. I love Gambi's hologram. Like Jessica said, it reminds me of Flash 220 when Cisco had the hologram of Barry because he couldn't use his powers. And I liked Anissa's like badass walk. I liked the whole car thing coming up, and then suddenly there's black lightning. It was all great. It all made total sense. Good job, guys. Totally worked. All right. And yeah, I think that's it. I love the family scene at the end, like family dinner before shit goes down in what I assume is the finale, right? No, there's two more episodes, right?
Yeah.
Two more. Okay, so shit is obviously going to go down, but it was nice to see everything be calm for a moment before the storm. So, what are our dislikes, if any?
Poor Anissa and her sharp intake of breath. I think because of what Jess said last episode, I was more in tune with it this time. Or maybe it was just more obvious because she tried to do it right into the cop's face and very much in public. Whereas before, she was doing it without anyone being around. Anyway, while I do think it was a strong episode, I still think that it's odd we haven't seen a glimpse of Tobias in 3 episodes. Or has it been more? I can't remember the last time I saw him even. Not even something where he's like off on his own plotting. And it just feels odd to me and took me out of the episode for a bit because I personally was wondering whether or not he was going to show up at all. And at this moment, given the fact that there are 2 more episodes left, I feel like there are too many loose plot threads to try and tie together before the season ends. I know that a lot of them are going to go into season 2 or whatever, but we still don't know what's up with Lala and how Lady Eve really factored into the whole plot, what Tobias will do, whether the children will be saved, how Tobias will tie into the overall ASA plot and all of this. And I'd also like to see Grace come back at some point because if they half-assed her relationship with Anissa, I'd be very annoyed. And given that I thought she would be a much bigger part of the season, I'm still a bit salty that she's only been in like 2 episodes. And I want Thunder Grace to rise, but they won't let it, and I'm upset.
Like that. That's my Anissa breath, like that damn breath. Like, I think that because I was complaining about it last week, I just laughed when she and Hill and their babe. It was funny.
That's what I was thinking about. I was like, oh, Jess is gonna.
She's gonna say something about the boldness to like go into a cop's face and just like breathe. Henderson save the day. I'm now like very, very afraid for his life. Like, you know, Tatiana says, like, what was your purpose? Oh, I see. You fulfilled your purpose. I'm like, well, no, next step is he's gonna die. Probably. Cause it's kind of like this is the second time in the past couple of episodes that I've been very worried that he was gonna die. Because like the first time he was following the gun deal and he was telling Black Lightning, make sure my wife knows I love her. I'm like, what? Why would you say that? He survived that time. He survived this episode. So you know what they say like about the third time. So it's just like a very ominous pattern that I'm very, very concerned for him. Like I said before, I'm okay with not seeing Tobias because unless he's on the other end of that encrypted line with Saudi, he just would not have fit thematically into the episode. However, seeing as how he also hasn't been in the previous few episodes, I can understand the worry. I feel like it would have helped more if he was in one of those 2 episodes, and it wouldn't have mattered as much why he wasn't in this one. I don't understand Cara Foudy's motivations at all. I get that she was conflicted over wanting to protect Jefferson and not believing he's Black Lightning because she has romantic feelings for him. But then what about her like attachment to her students, her responsibility as an educator? Like, you see, she's like very much in the beginning of the episode in charge and talking about these kids like they're specimens and, you know, like I keep my quota up and all this kind of stuff. So she clearly has no problem with that. I don't really understand why, like how long, did she start in this position as a vice principal just so she could like kidnap kids? Like, I don't get it. She can't possibly feel like she's doing the right thing. Like, I don't know. Like, this can't be like another Gambi. I was so naive and young. Because Gambi, when he found out that they were actually like trapping kids, he stopped, but she's like overseeing the moving of the tanks and all this kind of stuff. So I don't know why she feels like this is the right thing to do. I don't know what she has against Black Lightning anyway, because, you know, I think she was all down for killing him, and she's okay for taking him down, but as long as it's not Jefferson under the mask. Cool. So what is it about Black Lightning that also makes her think, like, the ASA is the right move? I don't really get it. And I agree about Thunder Grace. Like, I think that if Chantal was only going to be in two episodes this season, then they should have let Chinoa live a little bit longer before, like, destroying that relationship. They weren't going to pull the trigger on Thunder Grace anytime soon, so...
I was going to say, about Saudi, I hadn't really thought of it that way because I don't care about her, but you're absolutely right that she doesn't make sense as an educator. It only makes sense if she was put into the ASA program and then placed at Garfield High to rise through the ranks, gain people's trust, and be able to oversee the collection of children, which makes her just a totally irredeemable and awful and gross, you know, evil person, which is fine if that's what they want to do. But then to also have this, like, weird interest in Jefferson, like, what could she possibly like about Jefferson if she is that kind of person? Because, like, obviously Jefferson is the opposite of that. So, yeah. I don't know. This clearly calls for a Foudy backstory episode where we learn how she was placed in the ASA and what she thinks she's getting out of it. Anyway, aside from that, I decided that the sharp intake of breath is a directorial choice, or, like, a writer choice. Like, they obviously just told her to do that, and or decided that they're gonna lean into it, because they like it. But I don't like it, so, you know, they should take my feelings into account. Maybe now that she has the lightning clap, or the thunder clap, that can replace, no, I mean, I guess she has to breathe to make it happen, but maybe that'll replace, she'll just clap instead, when she's gonna start powers. That'll be fine. I also don't like that Jefferson's obviously going to die. And like you said, there was no place for Tobias in this episode, so it's a retroactive problem, but it's still so weird to me that it's been three episodes and there's no Tobias. Same with that it's been however long it's been since Lala resurrected. I guess the same amount, right? It's been three episodes since Lala resurrected.
Yep.
And we are not any closer to, like, knowing how that's going to play into anything. Maybe it's all lead up to next season, you know? And, like, Magic will have more of a role next season, but in that case, we didn't need to have him resurrect so early and be taking up screen time in the last couple episodes without really knowing. I like the hologram for Candy, like I said, but the fact that the ASA was that easily fooled by a hologram of Black Lightning suggests to me that they're just kind of dumb. They're not really good at being villains, because...
I don't think they were... Foudy was fooled because she wanted to be, but I don't think that
so
they
were... So then they were like, So they only let him go because...
They didn't
because
let...
Henderson. Henderson let him go, is what I'm saying. Like, they only let him go because of Henderson.
Go, though. They didn't let him go because they were just...
Well, I meant they, by, like, the police let him go because of Henderson.
Yeah.
So they weren't fooled. Foudy was fooled. All right, well, she's dumb, and I already know that she... But I don't like her, so it's fine. but like, I would assume they're hopefully still going to be looking into Jefferson, because even whether or not he's Black Lightning, it's unlikely that Black Lightning showed up in that cellar at that moment, unless Jefferson knows him, or, you know, like, why would he know to go there? So hopefully we'll see them still going after Jefferson just as hard in the next episode, is my point. Yeah, still confused by Grace, because Anissa called her a couple episodes ago, and again, nothing happened. She hasn't even mentioned that Grace didn't call back, or, you know, said no thank you or anything. So yeah, again, it's another thing that we could have held back on, or at least explained what's going on there. So yeah, it's just basically a lot to address. We have a lot of questions and two episodes in which to answer them, or to establish that they're actually set up for next season, which we are getting. Yay! Speaking of having two episodes left, what do we think is going to happen in them? Predictions that we can be super wrong at.
Mine is only that Foudy will unshady herself and try to help Jefferson, but will probably die. And that's all I got. I know, that's...
People are going to die.
I mean, I could see her, like, make... Maybe if she comes to her senses and she realizes, oh my god, this really is terrible because I'm totally in love with Jefferson. And she decides to, I don't know, sacrifice herself. I'm reaching here, but, you know. It could happen.
No, I hate that. That's awful.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
But it could happen. Just saying.
Well, we have been wrong before, so.
Yes, don't, like, listen to us, folks. We're always wrong.
Tell us Kathy, what do you have?
What do I have? Well, I basically agree that Jefferson Henderson's going to die. Because if it isn't him, it's Gambi. And because one of them's not making season two, so it's probably going to be Henderson. And I, you know, mentioned that Anissa has not mentioned not hearing back from Grace, which kind of puts a damper on my theory. But I think that maybe she is one of the kidnapped people or someone who has display powers. And then when we next see her, she will have them. Or be in a pod.
That means she would have to have taken green light. But I like your Grace theory, you know. Or she could have if she thought it was like a fun drug and then like stuff happened. So
it was not that fun, yeah.
It's not that fun. I really don't think they're gonna kill off Gambi because one, like the writers clearly love him. Two, I doubt that we'll be completely done with the ASA storyline by the end of the season. So he's the connection to that. So I think that there's still stuff that the Pierce family can learn from him. So he's like a source of knowledge. And then also three, he's the only tech person, quote unquote, on the show. And they need someone to make the suits. So
yep. That makes sense.
Jennifer still needs a suit. So he can't die until he makes it. Unless they're going to like hire some new young white guy as the new computer science teacher at Garfield High. I'm sure he's probably fine. Henderson, not so much. I'll be really surprised and happy if he survives this season, because I think there should be at least one good cop in the Freeland Police Department. I am concerned about the pod kids, and I hope one of them gets put into place soon, if nothing else, just to make it clear exactly what the ASA wants from them, because I don't really know why they've been on ice for 30 years. You know, where do they, like, I don't get what the ASA wants from them. And then they're dying now, so, like, get one out so we can see. Save one of the kids, please. hopefully, like, someone will, like, wake up and we'll figure out what the whole pod situation is.
I think that it's time for nominations of Ladies with Gumption. So, you got anything for me, Ladies with Gumption?
This is difficult.
Yeah.
I'm gonna nominate Amaya for side A. Well, yeah, it is side A. But I was gonna say, I'm gonna nominate Amaya. I'm going to nominate Amaya for Legends because she followed through with what she believed in. She inspired her future daughter, and she was the reason that Zambezi was saved. And her plan was better than everyone else's plans.
I will second this. I will second this because, yeah, I feel like Amaya hasn't really gotten to have as much attention as I thought she would, given the fact that her storyline was at supposedly at the center of this entire season, but she hasn't been given the attention, and neither has her granddaughter. So I'm happy that she finally did, even if it was like one episode before the finale. But I agree with all that you said, and I'm just adding on so that we don't have to repeat.
I'm going to third because I have nothing else.
Oh, no. Yeah, I mean, it is kind of hard because, again, it's another instance where I would say Jennifer just because I'm always so impressed with Chyna's acting, but she's not getting to do that much. So it doesn't really count.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, Amaya for side A.
That was easy.
So we will take a quick break and we'll be right back with side B, baby Krypton, but mostly Arrow. Clarity! See you soon.
Welcome back to Ladies with Gumption. We recapped DC TV in a flash. I am your side B introductress into your hostess. Makes no sense. I am May, and I'm here with
Jessica
and still Tatiana.
And once again, as a reminder, you can reach us on Twitter at DCTVGumption. You can send us your lovely thoughts at ladieswgumption@gmail.com or send in your asks to our individual Tumblrs. Tatiana's is Valerie and Perez. Jessica's is Falling in Love in a Flash. And I, your second favorite, is... I kid, I don't know.
Why am I the least favorite?
Because it's opposite thing. You're the most.
you know what? They love all their children equally.
Right. Yes, love us all equally. And you can find me on Tumblr at Her Own Hero Writer. Now we are moving into side B. We will give a mini reaction / impressions of Krypton episode 3. We will not recap it. And we will move into the big debate on Arrow this episode. And this side is called Clarity. And I will let Tatiana take it away from my rambling.
It's time for our singular thought on Krypton. So, episode 3 impressions. When I wrote down my impressions, I literally wrote them as I was watching it 3:00 in the morning. So my impressions make no sense. But I enjoy Adam Strange's interactions with Hollow Grandad quite a bit. But on the flip side, Hollow Grandad, Val-El, is way too realistic. He just seems like he's just there, like an actual dude is talking with them, and that dude just cannot leave the Fortress of Solitude. So, I don't know. Fix that, guys. Make him look like a hologram. Anyway, Nyssa sidling up to Seg is incredibly annoying, obviously, but I don't have as much of a problem with that, because, you know, whatever, love triangles, you have to do them, I guess, as I do with not knowing what her and her dad's plan is, or, like, what their connection is to the many faces of Rao. You know, like, they seem to be working for the religion in some way, but I don't know what way, and I don't know anything with the religion, so I really don't care. We also don't really know what the Black Order is. Maybe they're connected somehow? Maybe they are the Black Order? I don't know, but I don't care. That's what I do know. I know that I don't care. So, I guess I will just continue giving impressions, because we're not going to do a big thing about it, but I love Kim, by the way. Kim is, like, my fave. He's totally random, but he's a great character also.
But wait, is that the bartender guy?
Yes! How do you not? That's the most important character on the show. No, I'm just kidding. He really does not matter, but I love him. And I like, again, it's because of Adam Strange, who is actually my fave dude. You know, I think that's clear. But, like, his interactions with Kim are also great. And his interactions with everyone are great. So maybe you should just see the Adam Strange show. I don't know. That would be fine. Adam Strange and the House of Zod. I did like Dev a lot more this episode, though. Like, I just like to, like, we actually know something about him as a character, right? That he's a stickler for the rules, and that's annoying. But he does respect Lyta, and he does, like, want to give her sound advice. But at the same time, I liked how Lyta sort of steps up on her own, right? Like, we keep seeing her push her own agenda that, of course, is one that we agree with, and she has to sort of, like, face off against, like, everyone in her life, right? Like, Seg coming up in the middle of her fucking raid where she's trying not to get people killed, and he's coming up to yell at her about this raid. They're like, someone's gonna die while he is distracting her, like, please stop. And then, of course, her mom doesn't trust her to be able to do a good job, and then there's Dev, who still, like, I don't really know how he fits. Like, I feel like they haven't even discussed their engagement. Do I only know that they're engaged because I was told? Or was that in the show, actually?
I don't think it was in the show.
No, actually, I do think it was in the show. It was right before, like, she and Seg had sex, I think. And he's talking about, well, I just got binded to this random chick. He's like, well, I'm binded too, so. We do know that they are promised to other people.
Okay, so yeah, but, like, I don't see, you know, I don't really, like, when you compare it to how Nyssa is with Seg, and then Dev with Lyta, like, it's, like, on two different levels. It's really weird. But anyway, that doesn't matter. I did not care about the overarching plot of this episode until that Rom girl was possessed, and that's just because I don't want to see any random girl die, right? So then I cared, but I think that's my issue. My issue with Krypton is that, like, I don't care about what's happening. There's only individual characters that I care about. Because it was 3:00 in the morning, I did not understand that they were calling it a sentry. It was a sentry that it was. I was like, what is this, Citrium? Is this, like... And by the end of the episode, once Rom was the sentry, I was like, oh, that's what that is. I get it. So yeah, it's not calling to me to learn more about its mythology or to understand, you know, all the things that are going on screen, even as I watch it. And then at the end, you know, I love that Lyta did trust Seg enough to give him the device that helped him save Rom. But I don't love, like, and, like, he had sort of explained to her what was going on, but not enough. I want him to, like, loop her in all the way. That would be great. Yeah, that, and then the fact that the signal's already sent to Brainiac seems dumb to me. Like, I think that was a mistake. Shouldn't the signal have not been sent to Brainiac? Because otherwise it's like, well, Brainiac knows what's up. I guess he's coming next season. He's just taking his time. He's just being really slow. He's got 10 other planets to eat before he gets here. Like, sorry, to collect. Galacticus eats planets. Brainiac collects planets. Okay. Other thoughts, ladies?
Tati basically gave a recap of the show.
I'm sorry. I have a lot of feelings.
I didn't enjoy this episode as much as the one last week. I thought it was kind of like, it went a little bit down for me. And I think much of my problem, and I think what Tati was kind of picking up on, is that with Krypton and its lead, they haven't really found their identity in the story yet. So, like, you know, like on America's Next Top Model, the others are like, you wear the clothes and let the clothes wear you. That's what basically how I feel about Seg and his plot, because he's not in charge of his story at all. It's just stuff that keeps happening to him, but he's not driving it. And the same with the people of Krypton and, like, the world building. We know, like, more about all the rich people that live in the clouds than we do about the people that live on the ground. And I think that's an issue. There's a lot of talk about the Rankless, but I don't really feel connected to them at all. And neither does Seg, to be honest. Doesn't really feel like he is. And it would be helpful if we got more of a feel for the people on the ground. Like, for one, like, show us Black Zero, because currently it just seems like a boogeyman meant to scare the rich people and fight violence on the poor people. So at least, like, show us that it is real and that they are plotting something so that, you know, something makes sense. And I feel like that's the only thing that Seg and the Rankless have in common is that the plot is happening to them and not through them. So I think that's an issue that Krypton needs to fix in order for it to feel, us to feel more connected to it. And then when you contrast that to the strongest character right now, development-wise, is Lyta. And I'm not mad at that at all, because she should have the story that she has as a leading lady. But it's almost like, you know, this could be House of Zod and not House of L right now, because the story, she's driving her own story and everything is driving through her. So it makes her more interesting. And right behind her, the only other interesting person is Adam. That's mainly based off of Sean's charisma as the character and things that he does. Like, when he hid behind Val-El, it was like, and Val-El's like, you know I'm a hologram, right? Like, funny moments, but that's just, like, his charisma as a character. And, like, Brainiac plot seems more like his plot than Seg's plot. Brainiac continues to be, like, threatening enough of a villain, but he's also, like, taking his time, so, like, I don't know what else we're gonna do until he gets there. Like, Nissa is probably the worst off, or maybe tied with Dev, because he's not really doing anything either. But the only things that she has is trying and failing to seduce Seg, and then following her father around Krypton. And, well, I take it back. She is excelling at one thing, and that's just looking expensive. Like, she's doing a very good job. Like, an expensive person. Like, she costs a lot of money, but that's about it.
Like, are you dripping? Yeah, there you go. Don't make no sense, because your character does not.
So I feel like whatever Wallace's plans were for Nissa when she talked to the writers is something, if it's something other than those two things, trying to seduce Seg and then following her father along, then I would be all for it, because I think that Nissa really needs something to make her stand out, because she's just not standing out right now. And then with respect to Seg and Lyta, like, I know they had to pump the brakes because the whole your mom killed my mom story, like, that's a problem, but it would have been nice to at least see a little bit of it, like, before he goes off to do something that might potentially kill him, like a be careful kiss or something like that would have been great. Still figuring itself out.
Yeah, to me, I feel like Seg was the most connected with the Rankless when he was in the bar scene in the very first episode. And I feel like that's as much of a personality we've seen from him. And, like, I agree. I liked certain parts of this episode. I still think Lyta is basically the most developed character of the show. And, like you said, she's driving her own story. Like, her values and her actions are clear, whereas Seg's are more muddled. And
yeah.
Just as writers, like, no investment in him because he isn't the one driving his own story, and that's a problem. But I love that Lyta is taking the initiative to ensure the Rankless aren't harmed and that, you know, her squad is doing their job in a humane way. She's already making enemies, and it's a sign that she's doing something right in the world. Seg is still wading through the waters of trying to stop Brainiac, but at the same time, I don't feel like he cares enough. I know he wants to save his planet, but I wasn't at all invested when he was trying to save Rome or Rom or whatever her name is. Sorry, see, I clearly don't care.
Rom-com.
Like, to me, she was just a character who showed up this episode, but the quote-unquote power of love or whatever, saving...
It reminded me of Supergirl when they were, like, when thinking of Ruby saves Rain, except we care about Ruby.
Yeah,
we know the dynamic, and we don't know who the fuck Ram and her daughter are.
Yeah.
They hear, like, I'm the only one that pays attention, because she, like, showed up, and they said they gave their condolences to Seg when his parents died. So, like,
no, I remember that, yeah.
Oh, we okay. Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean anything. It's just like random person coming to say, you know, I'm sorry that your parents died, which is great and fine. But I feel like to Seg specifically, there was no emotional impact, no emotional tether.
But was that episode 1 or episode 2 when she did that?
That was 2, I think.
It was 2? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I just remember thinking at the end of episode 1, I was like, I'm glad that Seg seems like an interesting lead. You know, he has a personality. He has a lot of different relationships. And so I'm glad, you know, whatever, that I'm going to care about him. And then after that, I just stop.
Yeah, exactly. And I also think them putting Seg and Lyta's romance on hold was a big mistake. Because I feel like they could have driven the story that way as well. And, like, these are two people who love each other. And up until two episodes ago, were in a relationship. So I get why Seg is acting distant now. Because, you know, Lyta's mom killed his parents. But he clearly sees Lyta trying to do something, and yet there's nothing showing him to be truly concerned. And I think it's Cameron's acting, because Georgina does a better job with her facial expressions, and I need him to step it up. Like, I wish he'd lean towards her in a way that suggests he wants to hold her even while remaining distant. Like, something to tell me he still cares, because it's clear he does.
You're saying that he's in the Stephen Amell acting school?
Yes, exactly. Try harder, Cameron.
More subtle. I was going to say, so we have a theme for side B, but whatever.
Yeah, like, I just need him to try harder. I feel like Georgina is trying harder than him. And I, like, just because her mom killed your mom doesn't mean you just automatically stop having feelings for her. That's not how this works. Anyway, I like Adam too, and I like that he just, you know, tried to steal the artifact from the merchant by trying to heckle him at first, and then he just ran away with it, which I thought was really funny. Finally, I give zero fucks about whatever is happening with Nissa and her father. I don't know what they're trying to do. I don't care what they're trying to do. I think the voice of Rao is creepy, so good for you, Krypton. But I actually feel the opposite about Brainiac. While I was initially excited about him, I no longer care about him much as a villain. Because he just feels like a passive villain. He's just... I feel like they're showing the same scene every time he shows up. It's like his face turns to the camera. And I'm like, okay. But nothing's happening. And I don't know if it was just me. But, like, are you telling me Brainiac was just going to wait around until someone happened to get infected by the Sentry? To me, it made no sense for a being that's being painted as a super intelligent villain to sit around and wait for someone to finally find this thing and then log on to send him all the details or whatever. So I think Krypton needs to focus more on its characters driving the story rather than the plot driving the story.
Interesting.
Yes, those are my two cents.
So that was quite an in-depth mini review of Krypton from all of us here at Ladies with Gumption. Next up will be Arrow. Are you ladies ready for my recap?
We are.
Born ready. All right. After much concerned prodding from Felicity, Oliver finally gets real with Diggle and tells him he's not getting the Green Arrow suit anytime soon. Diggle is upset by this, and nobody knows why. So Lyla tells him to do some soul-searching and figure it out. And it takes a decent apology from Oliver, which is quite a surprise, and a botched questioning of a Diaz associate for Diggle to finally figure it out. He doesn't like not making the calls because he doesn't like the calls that Oliver is making. So he tells Oliver that he's such a bad leader, that the team is falling apart, and that Diaz has literally taken over the whole city, including the cops and the DA's office, without skipping a beat, all because of you, Oliver. So they literally start blaming loved ones' deaths on each other while trading blows before Felicity finally shows up and breaks them up. They set aside their differences as Green Arrow and Spartan to take down Diaz's Vertigo Supply Network for the time being, but Diggle still believes every word of his angry rants. He apologizes, but more so because he meant it. So even though he's calmer, he tells Oliver he has to walk away for his own good because Oliver's attention is too split between dadding, arrowing, and mayoring, and Diaz is already winning. Meanwhile, over in the Mayorland, Oliver fires Captain Hill and the DA for working with Diaz. They accuse him of being Green Arrow and remind him Again, that Diaz is already one. Which makes sense, because every cop in Star City is working for Diaz, except for Dinah and Curtis's new boyfriend, Nick. Speaking of Nick, he hates vigilantes, which really sucks for Curtis, but Dinah gives him the peppiest of pep talks, and then it turns out that Nick is actually cool with vigilantes if they are named Curtis. Plus, Dinah and Nick were just fired from Star City PD for not being dirty enough, so why not join Team Vigilante? Finally, there is the whole Laurel side of things, which I like, because that just means Laurel Lance. Anyway, Lance tells her to get a job, so she starts reading some law books, and that gives her the great idea to impeach Oliver as mayor. So the episode ends with the Captain Hill and the DA saying that they are going to get rid of Mayor Queen, because he's the fucking Green Arrow anyway. All right, that's what you missed on Arrow. Before we get into what we liked about this episode, Jessica is going to recap our favorite Arrow viewer, Tasha's email.
Yeah. Our special Arrow correspondent, Tasha, sent in an email for 16 and 17. And so basically, like she says, in general, she just really struggles with the midseason of Arrow. It usually starts off strong, and they usually end strong, but the episodes in the middle, which is like a lot of treading water and randomness, it kind of like slows down the middle. So we can say the same thing about Flash probably. So I think that's like an overall superhero. There's too many episodes and there's a lot of filler. She enjoyed 616. She thought Thea and Roy were great. She's glad that Thea left with a purpose and has the option for all of them to return before the series finale. Nyssa and Felicity is the antagonistic ship that she didn't even know she needed, but the husband-sister-wife jokes were glorious. Katrina Law is everything, and if her new show is anything like Power, then I'm sure it'll be a success. So I guess Katrina got picked up for a new show that will be starting soon. On to 617. So for this episode, to sum up her reaction, you just finally could give Martin Lawrence going the woosah, because that's like how she felt about this episode. But starting with her likes, she likes that Lila made a comeback, and that her, because her and Nyssa are her favorite characters and all the guest characters in all the Arrowverse. She likes Oliver's new trick Arrow, so Oliver still has, he's an old dog with some new tricks, so that's always good to see. She kind of brags a little bit because she told us that Black Dragon was going to happen, and we didn't believe her, so she was totally right that they did become a thing. There's a ton of focus on OTA this episode. She likes Anatoly, and she wishes, and his dynamic with Oliver, and she wishes that he was a big bad instead of Diaz, which I kind of agree. I think it would have been a much better payoff if Anatoly was the big bad with Diaz as the muscle.
And then that makes me laugh, so.
Yeah. The performances, she thought David Ramsey and Paul Blackthorne are the best actors on the show, and they elevate whoever they're in a scene with, and then pair that with the great chemistry of David and Steven, and we get something pretty amazing. So those were her overall likes for 617.
I didn't hate the entire fight. I texted these ladies and I was like, I thought I would roll my eyes for the majority of the episode, but actually I found myself quite engaged. I absolutely agree that this is some of the best acting David Ramsey and Stephen Amell have done on the show in a long while. There was so much anger in their eyes, I almost felt myself shrinking back from it. And while I also had problems with some of the reasoning behind the actual fight, which will be my dislikes, I did like that it wasn't immediate within the episode, and that there was at least some sort of build-up to it. I like that Diggle thought it was stupid as well. Like, he thought the fight was stupid because he was, I feel like the writers were being like, yeah, we know this is kind of dumb, so we're gonna have him say it. And then he sought out Lytle for advice to be a sounding board, which is really nice because we haven't seen her in ages. Their discussion felt natural, and I also like that Diggle, but that he took the time to think on why he was actually angry with Oliver, and then it wasn't just about the Green Arrow suit. Lila offering him a job seemed like a good next step, and something I've always wondered why Diggle didn't do more of. I actually like that Oliver apologized and that it felt genuine, because he doesn't do apologies well and everyone's made a comment on it. But to Diggle, it just felt like he actually meant it. I feel like, because him and Diggle have had the longest relationship on the show, and it really was showcased here in a way that was both for and against them. I also feel really invested in Dinah and Curtis's friendship, and I'm glad that it's gone back to being lighthearted following the team's divorce. I like that Dinah teases Curtis about everything and thought it was cute that she was like, I'll go find an excuse to leave when Nick came around. I thought that was really nice. And Nick, so cute, And I'm glad that whole vigilante thing was resolved because I like him and Curtis together. I also like that Dinah continues leading the subplot and seems to be making the most headway regarding Diaz. Finally, I like that Laurel seems to enjoy lying around Quentin's house and thought it was cute that he wanted to get her a job. It was also well played that she used her law books to take down Oliver, which was, I thought, was really smart.
Yeah. I didn't hate this episode as much as I thought I would either. Like, I felt like on Twitter, where it's like, two brothers, one hood. Or like, two girls, one cup. But yeah, like, this episode, I think, might have been one of the stronger ones, at least for me, kept me engaged, which was odd because I didn't think it would. I think Dinah continues to have a strong subplot alongside with Curtis. I'm glad that they have moved her on from the revengeful canary, because I thought that was just like not doing her any favors. She just continues to lead the B plot, which just proves the writers clearly enjoy like writing her, and it makes her seem more like Oliver's equal slash rival. Like when they were bickering at the police district, these are like two leaders of their teams, like going back and forth with each other. And I feel like this is always how it should have been with the Laurel in the first place. That this kind of like Dinah Ollie situation should have been Laurel, Dinah, and Ollie from the beginning, but, you know, I'm not bitter. I thought the plan that she had with arresting Anatoly with the Green Arrow as backup and then Oliver as the mayor and Quentin having her back was really clever, even if it still didn't work out in the end. So it shows that they don't really have to like each other, but they still are, and on some level, respect each other's positions that they can work together for a plan. I like Curtis and Dinah as a pair, even though I still miss Renee. It feels like Curtis has shifted from just being Felicity's BFF prop, whatever, to more complimentary to Dinah. And it's a boost up for Curtis, because usually he's just talking about tech. And with Dinah, it's a little bit more of like a family bond kind of thing. And I like, that's what I like about new Team Arrow's bond. Like, they're very supportive of each other. So I did like that her supporting his relationship and serving his story as much as he serves her story. Yeah, I don't think he really had that before. So it was good for him. I like Lila being a source of support and wisdom for Diggle while he's trying to figure himself out. And I agree. Like, I'm glad that he knew that his fight was stupid, because it was. So I'm like, I'm glad you know. So that was good. And because I've been like harping on the Elicity dynamic for a while, I tried to be like, pay close attention to Diggle's dynamic with Lila to see, you know, comparison, what was going on. And they didn't do a lot of touching or kissing either, but Diggle, it wasn't really a touching, kissing kind of situation. He wasn't really in the frame of mind for comfort as he was for guidance. Plus, it still felt like he was connected and invested in the conversation, so it felt real. It felt like these are two people that have been married for a while and they kind of are in their groove. Even though we don't see Lila at all, it just still feels like they're married. I liked the actual lead-up to... Well, I thought the actual lead-up to the fist fight was going to be, like, the dumbest of all, but I kind of liked it a lot. Like, I thought once Diggle knew what he was actually mad about and his reason why he was mad about it, why he wanted the hood, was as strong as Oliver's reasoning why he felt that he needed it. And, like, I thought that they had a good back-and-forth where Diggle was like, well, Oliver didn't, like, he listened to Diggle, but he didn't take Diggle's bashing when he felt that it was, like, incorrect. Like, Diggle's right. Trying to blame Renee's injuries on him, and Oliver's like, well, you were taking drugs in the first place, that's how you got injured in the first place, so it's not Oliver's kind of thing. So I thought their fight was really good and really believable, because he was, like, frustrated or whatever. And then their physical fight actually lasted for, like, 2 seconds, but I guess, like, boys are like that. They have, like, one fight and then they're fine afterwards, so...
That's why I thought they were going to make up by the end of the episode.
Yeah, it devolved into something else, but I like the intensity of it, and I thought both John and Steven had a lot of emotion in it, and it made the fallout kind of worth it. Like, it was a really good scene for both of them acting-wise. And then with Quentin and Laurel, I just thought it was really funny when he basically told her to get off the couch and get a job. It's like when, like, kids come home after they graduate college and they're just, like, lazing around the house, and their parents are like, get a job! So it kind of reminded me of that. And I still think Diaz is stupid, but if nothing else, I too like the fact that he told Laurel that he likes that she's not trying to force herself into E1 Laurel, and that she Because I like that she's not trying to change herself and that she's still being who she is, even that if who she is a chaotic neutral and kind of like doesn't really have a good or a bad kind of vibe to her. So I like that she still, it doesn't seem like they're trying to like force her into being good Laurel. They're just making a new Laurel fit in this world.
I have a lot of likes.
I did. This might be a record.
The Diggle-Oliver fight was some of the best acting I've seen from either of them in years. The intensity was really believable, and I liked the episode spent a lot of time on Diggle and letting him have the space to figure out why he was upset. I thought, you know, it was kind of cool that people were actually like, I don't get it. Can you please explain to me why you're angry? Because we also did not get it. So we did need to work up to the explanation. And for part of it, you know, I wasn't as on board with the whole, you know, content of the fight, but for the most part, it did make sense that he was feeling like Oliver wasn't as good of a leader as he used to be, right? Like that whole, like, oh, you become a better person, but like a worse leader. I don't know that, well, I'll say the rest of that another time. But for now, I liked how he made his position known. And I think it speaks to the overarching theme that they want to give us. Like, they want this idea of Oliver not being able to juggle all these balls, right? He has to have his full attention on something. And just like the season started with him being outed against his will as Green Arrow, predictions. But it works with, he has to, all those separate identities have to become one for him to be the best version of himself. If the Green Arrow is the best version of Oliver Queen, then Oliver Queen has to be the Green Arrow. And that is what Diggle is saying. I also liked how they sort of put on their, you know, business hats or their save the day hats after Felicity yelled at them. And they made it through a day's mission. And then Diggle was very mature when he gave his decision to leave. And Oliver, you know, maturely let him. So that was nice, especially after all the fighting and punching and, you know, strong acting happening all episode. I loved Lila giving John advice. I thought that they were very sweet together. And it was, thank God that we saw her again. I almost forgot what she looked like. And I enjoyed her offering him a job at Argus. I think that that would actually be a really cool subplot to actually see them at Argus and, like, see what that would be like. Probably wouldn't last very long because, you know, status quo must reign supreme, so he'd eventually return to Team Arrow. But I think it'd be cool to see that for a few episodes. For the side plots, I always love seeing Dinah as a cop. So it was enjoyable to see her sort of, like, trying to battle this corrupt system with Curtis as her sidekick. I really love their friendship. I, like you guys have already said, I love the sense of family that they have. I love how lighthearted they can be now. And even though we don't see Renee's daughter, Zoe, even though we don't see Zoe, it's nice that he's always, like, talking about taking care of her and how he likes it. So, I don't know. I think it's cool. It gives us more of a sense of who they are as people than we've gotten to see when they're on Team Arrow. Because all you do on Team Arrow is talk about Team Arrow. It's like the opposite of Fight Club. I really like his blossoming romance with Nick or Anastas. I don't really, you know, whatever. So I like how the vigilante reveal worked out. I liked that it was just literally like, oh, you got shot. Oh, what the fuck? You're a vigilante? And then Dinah was like, you know, it's all for the best. However he, you know, reacts to it, you're being authentic. You're living your best life. So it's all going to be fine. And then Nick comes back and is like, oh, it's cool. So anyway, I like the whole thing. It's very fun. And I like the idea of them fighting the system now that they're literally the only ones left. Everyone else is evil. And speaking of which, I like that the police captain and the DA had reasons for why they're working with DS. Like, he is threatening their loved ones. It's not just like he offered them money or whatever and they're like, okay, cool. Or, you know, he offered them vertigo and that's cool with them. So I like that they aren't wholly evil. Like, they are sort of working under duress. Finally, I know Laurel's still working with Diaz, which is, but I loved how protective she was of Quentin. When Diaz shows up and she's like, if you think that you're going to put pressure on Quentin Lance, you have another thing coming because I am not injured right anymore and I will kill you. So that was great. And I loved him telling her to get a job too. That was when I said it. Jessica was like, "Yeah, it's like every parent telling their child to get a job after they come home from college," and that's exactly what it was like. He was like, "You're here on my couch every day, complaining about everything. So why don't you just get a job and help pay the bills? Thank you." And I liked how he didn't even seem to like. He was like, "Laurel was good at the law. You'll probably be good at it too. Just read some fucking books." And then and she's like, "I don't even have a resume. Like, what am I gonna put on my resume?" He's like, "Who the fuck needs a resume? You're Laurel Lance." This guy was like, "I'm ready to go back to work." That was great. And I wish that we could see that. I would love to see Laurel trying to fake it as a lawyer and not know shit. It would be like Suits, but sorry, Laurel Lance. Anyway, yeah, I thought it was cool that she came up with the plan to sort of impeach Oliver or whatever, you know, that whole thing. And that she got it just from reading those law books. So it shows that she is kind of brilliant. And like Jessica already said, she's just serving her own agenda. She doesn't really give a fuck about anything other than Quentin. So what did Tasha not like?
Well, she's tired of Dinah taking shots at Oliver and being unwilling to own up to her part in the mess that things became, but she does appreciate that Oliver stood up for himself and they had, like, it was a back and forth, not just someone yelling at him and him taking it. But she is less pleased with the Quiggle, destruction of the Quiggle bromance. She agrees that it was an embodiment of writing for plot over character. They wanted Oliver to be as isolated as possible, but having Diggle, who is a person that's the biggest proponent of Oliver getting a life, having a family, and having all these things, because being the hood wasn't enough, to now being the person saying that he's a bad hero because he has all of these things is just ridiculous. And it's made even more absurd by the fact that Diggle also has all of these things. And so how can he be any better in this role than Oliver, which I totally agree with. She does think that she doesn't have an issue with the fact that Diggle had a meltdown in general, because he's been overdue one. He's had a lot of stuff happen in his life as well, and carries a lot of guilt for his brother's death, for Laurel's death. Daughter became a son. He had a military turn on him, so he's had a lot of shit happen to him. So when he is freaking out, that's not really, he's earned his freak out, but the issue comes from the fact that it's happening now in the middle of the worst crisis, and involves questioning Oliver's leadership, because, like Oliver said, and it is true, Diggle was right there when all those decisions were being made and didn't say anything about it. So it's just kind of, like, really weird why it's, you know, all of a sudden now Diggle's like, "Well, I didn't like this." Like, well, you didn't say anything for the past couple episodes. So, you know, it's understandable that Oliver wouldn't know why he's that upset. And then poor Felicity being stuck, being the rational one between her big moody husband and his big moody brother. She thought that the use of dead loved ones was very out of character, and that they have forced all the characters to where they want them to be. And while she didn't like the way that it was done, she is interested to see where it goes. So Diggle solo missions and Oliver solo missions to see what each character learns from it. So that's what her hope is, that this, what will come out of this bad situation.
Yeah, I mean, while I agree that it's hypocritical that Diggle would say those things to Oliver, given that he has a family too, I feel like the show doesn't care as much, obviously, about Diggle's family. So that's just like we saw him suit up as the Green Arrow to begin with, even though he has a son. They didn't care that he was saying these things to Oliver, because it doesn't matter that Diggle has a family. The writers don't care. So that's like the biggest difference. I really dislike the fact that Laurel is shown for the third time to be working under a male who is seemingly more powerful than she is. And I really hope they show us more backstory to how she decided to work with Diaz and what's in it for her, because I still don't understand how she keeps hopping from one big bad to the next. Like, what is she getting out of it? And we hear a lot about who she should be based on Quentin and now Diaz's perception of her, but who does Laurel ultimately want to be herself? So it's like a decision I hope she eventually makes on her own without outside pressure. While I kind of agreed with Diggle in that Oliver has become a worse leader. He's not a bad Green Arrow. He's a good Green Arrow. But he, like Diggle said, he doesn't unify people. And that's what I agree with. Like, he prefers to be dad, and that's great. But I think that he doesn't bring people together. And I think that's what true leadership is. So I feel like that started back even in season 5 with all the newbies, because he didn't instill that trust, you know? But I still think the whole fight is completely stupid and felt like it came out of left field, because even when Diggle was salty that he wasn't going to get back in the Green Arrow suit, it wasn't to the extent that we saw in this episode. And it wasn't even about the suit in the end. So it just felt more like the writers were trying to find a reason for Diggle to leave on his own instead of being kicked off by Oliver. I thought throwing Samantha and Andy, I agree with Tasha, in each other's faces was cruel and unwarranted. And I also don't understand what's going on. Okay, so outside of the Diggle and Oliver fighting, I also don't understand what's going on with Stephen and Mel's acting in his scenes with Felicity, because he was really trying in the fight scenes with Diggle. You could see him, his frustration and the fire in his eyes. And in every other scene with everybody, even the two, like, you know, Captain Hill and the DA, you could see him being, like, very frustrated and his acting. It was like, it was there, you know? But whenever Emily Bett-Ricard goes up to him and makes a choice to tug at his collar or give him a little flirty lean-in and puts her hands on his chest, he just stays rigid, and I don't understand. He does not reciprocate. He doesn't take his hands out of his damn pocket. He doesn't even lean down. And sometimes he doesn't even look at her. So I don't understand if this is a personal choice in Steven's acting. And if it is, it's a bad one because he's supposed to look like he's in love with his fucking wife. And that's not the vibe that I get. All I know is that Emily needs to pull her co-star aside and have a chat with him because it is not looking good on screen. Like, this is the ship of the show. Get it together, Steven. She's trying. You are not. Give a little bit. Finally, I don't understand Diaz and what he truly wants. Like, is it just that he wants to bring Star City down? If so, why? Like, what's his end game? And I completely dislike the fact that he was really trying to go for this Jeffrey Dean Morgan voice because he didn't used to talk like that before. And it was really, really obnoxious. Also, like, Diggle firing those two employees, like, HR, that's retaliation 101. He should have known better.
And Oliver,
what was that?
Oliver probably firing them.
Yeah, you said Diggle, I think. You meant Oliver?
Oh, yes, Oliver finally.
It's okay,
him.
I called Henderson Jefferson, so.
Yeah, so, like, he should have known better. That's, like, HR 101, man. Retaliation. You don't do that and expect, especially when you're like, oh, it's like me coming into an office and be like, you can talk to me about everything, and then get the hell out. I don't agree with you, so you're fired. And I laughed out loud when someone, and I can't remember who, mentioned that Diaz is unlike anyone Oliver's ever faced, because I think that's, like, a lie.
Well, he is unlike anyone in that he's not doing anything. So it's like, how do I find a villain that's not doing shit?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the not moving first, because I was like, I feel like I've been, like, you know, harping at it. And I told myself that I was not going to do that. But then this episode happened, and then I feel like, because I've seen, like, tweets online about, there's a lot of Lucy fans are actually, like, really starting to pick up and hone in on it, and are also getting frustrated, so I'm like, it's not just me, so I validate it in that, but if I back up a little bit, I guess what, overall, I liked the fight between Quiggle. But what I didn't like was the precursor to the fight, which was them going to get info from the drug dealer and Diggle going off script. Like, went from 0 to 100 real quick. And his intensity in that moment to force the drug dealer to confess seemed very out of character. And so did the aftermath, where he just kind of blew up on Oliver for no reason. I'm like, you know, Diggle, you're doing too much. Stop. I thought that was the most forced part of that whole fight in the episode, I felt like. And I thought that Oliver was the more mature and sensible person in that respect. And then in the fight, I thought it was weird that the writers seem to be setting up through Diggle that Oliver can't be Mayor, Dad, and Green Arrow, and that he became a worse leader because of it. So I agree with Tasha completely. It's like, this just too much. I don't think that's the right message to set up that it's the hero's fault that he wants to be happy, because it's just, you want the hero to be happy. And so to kind of, like, you know, say you were a bad, worse leader because you want a life is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like the show saying that he is only a good leader if he's forever miserable, which I feel like they're trying to really do with Oliver, like this tragic hero.
They're trying to do this Batman thing with him.
Yeah.
And that's not even true for Batman, so I don't like it. Other things, back to the whole Elicity of it all. I don't know, like, I don't really know what it, if it's like, if they're trying to, because it's a personal acting choice. It's not written in the script that, you know, Oliver stands stiff as a board and does not move towards Felicity or, you know, whatever. That's not a writing choice or an acting choice. It's something that Steven is doing. But I don't know if he's doing it because it's plot related. Like, we know in the next episode that he and Felicity have a falling out. So I don't know if this is like a mental choice to prepare for like the, oh, you're disconnected from me, I need some space kind of thing later on. But it's just, it's odd. And I don't understand why it's happening. He's done much better before. So it's clearly not, there's nothing new to his relationship with Emily in real life. So they're fine. So it's got to be, something plot related, because I don't understand otherwise. Like, why else would he be this disconnected in scenes from her? Which she's clearly leaning in and doing like a lot of the work. But it's just like a kind of a weird disconnect.
I feel like it can't be plot related, just because I feel like it's been consistent since the wedding.
Yeah,
you know?
But I mean,
well, like, not since the reception.
Diggle didn't really have a problem until, like, today. So, I mean, I guess, no. But if it's not
part of... Here's the thing, like, because Diggle, like you said, Diggle's anger just came popped up out of nowhere, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we gotta do that. So, like, if it was plot-related, we would have heard about it by now. You know what I mean? Like, on-screen. It's, like, it seems like on-screen, Felicity doesn't even register that Oliver isn't receptive to her. You
right.
know?
Mm-hmm.
It's, like... I'm sure Emily has noticed, but they haven't made it a plot point yet. If I could totally be wrong. Like, next week, she could say, like, you won't even touch me anymore. And then I'll be like, oh, Jessica was right. But
I don't know what else it is, because it's just, I don't know.
I don't know either. And it is really bothering me. Like, it really, like, it takes me out of their scenes together. And it makes me, it just makes me start up conspiracy theories. It's like the opposite of, I don't know, like, people always complain on The Flash because Vera and Iris don't get, like, intimate scenes. But they make every scene intimate, mm-hmm. because they're, like, you know, constant the face touching, as we know. And the Caucasian dress!
Yes!
And even in moments where you know that I love you wasn't there, Grant will drop it in, you know? Like that window, that fucking window scene. Just because the script doesn't say he caresses her arm and says, I love you, or thank you, or whatever, after she spoke, you know? Or because the director doesn't care enough to put it in, doesn't mean that as an actor you can't include that. Like, that window scene of them in this last episode, it just died. And then it was broken by the phone. But, like, when the phone rings, usually it's because it's interrupting something. But it wasn't interrupting shit. He was just waiting for his phone to ring. So that he could leave the scene.
And I think
people don't get that more play in this episode than Oliver and Felicity. Like, they got, like, a kiss, you know, and was until she shot him. But, I mean, Diaz got more action with Laurel than Oliver and Felicity. Like,
and I feel like, well, I just want to drop in that, like, people don't understand that scripts don't really, they're bare bones, you know? It's, like, up to an actor a lot of times about what to do in certain situations or directors. So I feel like this is not just a one-off thing, and it's really weird.
Yeah, because I would say that Steven just doesn't know what to do when he's not being told, but he used to know what to do. He used to add a lot more into their scenes. It's not just Emily, even though Emily, I think, is a large part of the reason why the ship soared so high even before it existed, because she just exudes charisma, you know? She has chemistry with everyone, and he's the lead, so of course she has the most chemistry with him. But he used to participate.
Yeah, and now he's cooperating, and I don't understand. But getting off back onto, like, the only other thing that I didn't like was at the office when he's talking to the corrupt police and the DA official. It was just, like, a bad move to be like, this is a safe space for you to come clean, and then, like, well, you're fired. Like, Oliver, you already don't have a lot of friends. You need some allies right now. So it probably was not the best move to fire your two officials that are not super corrupt because they are under duress. Oh, and I also, like, I know, like, Tasha, I know you're right, and Black Dragon is a thing, but still doesn't mean I have to like it. I don't like it.
Yes.
Like, baking it until she makes it, because I'm not here for her and Diaz.
Black Dragon is one of my largest dislikes, so I'm right there with you. The Diggle-Oliver fight doesn't really make sense to me, because it's been seeded so extremely poorly. Like, John looks nonsensical for half the episode, and then once he finally explains it, I'm like, oh, okay, I know where this is going. especially because it's not even like John doesn't really get to the heart of what he's angry about until the very end. And like I was saying before, it's the theme of the season. Like, he's literally speaking as the writer. What you guys already said about this is writing for plot and not for character. John is now the mouthpiece for the writers. Oliver can't be all these things at, you know, separately. He has to be one person, and that's how the season's probably going to end. But that doesn't mean that John has to be the one to say that. Like, and not in that way either. Like, so whatever. It doesn't make sense. The stuff they said was super shitty. I remember May was like, how are they ever going to make up, you know, after this? And I was like, they'll fucking make up by the end of the episode because nothing matters anymore. But, and in a way they did. Like, they forgave each other immediately for the shit they said. And then Diggle just left because, you know, he couldn't watch Oliver fail. So yeah, nothing, it feels like nothing matters anymore, basically. I also didn't like how Felicity was relegated to sort of playing referee between them, playing the peacekeeper. First, it's just like she's waiting around for them to talk to each other, right? Are you going to talk to John yet? Are you going to talk to John yet? And then he talks to John. He's like, you're going to talk to John now? This is when you just started to John? I don't like how you talk to John. I think you should talk to John like this. Stop talking. And then that was just like what she did all episode. And then at the end, and, you know, she does showcase her emotional maturity in comparison to theirs. And that's cool. But Felicity has a lot more going on than being more emotionally mature than two babies. So I would like to see a little bit more of that, like her getting to forward the plot in a different way. And that, I feel like that hasn't happened since the Helix episode. Or perhaps the crossover, because it was her refusal to marry Oliver and then her decision to marry Oliver. So she moved the plot forward then. Okay, so I already explained my feelings about how unsettling it is that Oliver won't even move towards Felicity while she's wrapping her arms around him. But he was really great in his scenes with Diggle.
Yeah.
Which makes it even more weird how not great he is in scenes with Felicity. Like, how are you going to look at Diggle with more love than you do Felicity, who is your wife? I don't know. And how come Laurel and Diaz have to be making out right in front of my salad? I definitely barf. It was gross. I never want to see it again. So yeah, I hate that Siren is still, like, even though I like that she's got her own agenda, and hopefully she's also, you know, willing to turn on Diaz at the drop of a hat, but I don't like that everything ties back, you know, to, like, I need protection, or I need this dude, or, you know, whatever. So I just want to see her fly free on her own in whatever way she wants to do that. The writing is very poor right now because they have an idea of where they want to go and they just write to that without actually stopping to consider what each specific character is saying. And I remember someone said in the thread about Arrow being like a student film or something that characters don't have a specific voice that's unique to them. And I felt like that was really true this episode. Like, Felicity has a voice, a unique voice, because of Emily and the way that she reads her lines and the humor that she brings to them. Aside from that, it is kind of like anyone could be saying the lines that the characters are saying because they're just there to serve the plot that the writers want to get across. And that's that.
That's well said. Yes, I agree.
Thank you. Do we have feelings about where the writers are going to take the plot next?
I feel like since this was dubbed as the season with the theme of family, that they're splitting everyone away from Oliver to eventually have them rally together like a family that they're going to realize they're all stronger together, basically. That's all I've got. And that, well, somehow Oliver's going to end up in a courtroom.
Tasha has a really good prediction for next week's episode, and her guess is that Laurel is going to dose Oliver with the vial of vertigo that Diaz gave her, so he acts crazy and alienates his family. And, because, you know, like, in the trailer, Felicity said we should take some space, and people are kind of, like, going after her for it. But, especially since you don't see the ring on her finger, so it's kind of like, I'm taking my ring off and I'm leaving. But she thinks that that might actually be a hallucination from the vertigo. So he's seeing, like, his worst fears, which includes his enemies and losing his wife and son, like he has lost everyone else, which I think is a really good. And if that's not it, then, you know, I'll be sad. Tasha should have been in the writer's room, because that's how it should have gone. So And then, like, for overarching season finale prediction, she said the EPs gave an interview where they said there would be an untraditional cliffhanger. And so she thinks that Oliver will get captured since he's alone and has nobody in the field. The newbies will save him because they have to be relevant somehow because they are coming back next season. And then during Oliver's trial, he's going to pull a Tony Stark and out himself as the Green Arrow, which lessens the load from having to lie about it. It's comic accurate that he's public about his identity. And it ties in with what he said in 615 about not wanting Roy and Diggle to carry the burdens that were meant for him. If he does go to jail in the finale, the team will reassemble to protect the city around season 7. And that could be about getting him out of jail because a threat comes that only the Green Arrow can stop. And she feels like that's the last step for him to go from being a vigilante to actual hero. So I think that's a good one.
Yeah, I really like that theory.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that Natasha's got in the bag. I mean, yep. She got Black Dragon right, so she obviously knows more about Arrow than
us. Listen to Tasha about, like, what is going to happen. For me, oh yeah, mine is just, like, a rehash of my gripe about them saying that he shouldn't have a family to be a better leader. So all of that, like, Felicity needing space next episode, coupled with Diggle's speech about him being a better man but a worse leader, seems like they're trying to gear up for finale, in which Oliver sabotages his career and his marriage for the good of the city. I like Tasha's better, that he actually outs himself as the Green Arrow and takes that accountability, because I think that that's what's was missing for me from him earlier in the plot with the whole OTA NTA thing, so... I'm going to co-sign Tasha and scrap my prediction.
Yeah, I also co-sign Tasha. And that is what I was thinking of when I was saying, like, what Diggle is saying just means that Oliver has to take responsibility for or join all his personas, not by getting rid of the others, but by making all of Oliver Green Arrow. So they'll probably find out that their mayor is the Green Arrow, and then they'll be like, well, you were cool anyway, thanks. Next season. Sort of like when the Mentalist killed Red John, and then he had a trial, and they were like, actually, it was a service to society by killing that dude, so you should set him free. Thanks! And then he got set free. So, anyway. Aside from that, I also agree, just to all of Tasha's predictions, that Felicity, you know, not having the ring on is a hallucination. Like, I'm sure that Vertigo will make him act out, and that will make him and Felicity fight, but she's not actually going to leave him, and anything that suggests that she would actually leave him is a hallucination. Exactly. And then by the end of the episode, they'll probably make up, and they'll be fine. Or, you know, whatever. Even if they're still on shaky ground, they'll still be husband and wife, it's fine. Finally, I feel like Laurel will finally switch sides, or at least leave Diaz's side, when Quentin is in trouble. Hopefully Quentin does not actually have to die for this to happen. Just get a little bit injured. Not. That's what you missed on our predictions. So, how about our Lady with Gumption noms of Side B? Are there any?
I mean, I think...
Lyta.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it bad to nominate her again? Because...
This was not a strong week for the ladies.
No.
I guess Lyta would be the Side B nominee. Because, I mean, I guess
Laurel would kind of come in sick. No, Dinah.
I think like Dinah and Laurel.
Yeah, I mean, all the Arrow ladies, the Laros, ladies of Arrow, did, you know, contribute towards being strong women. Like Felicity was setting the men to rights and getting them on track, and Dinah was fighting the system, and Laurel was coming up with better plans than Diaz. But I don't know that any of them were like, they didn't really have enough time for me to feel like,
I agree. So Lyta, I guess, wins.
Yes, Lyta wins Side B. So between Lyta and Amaya, who wins episode 30? Dirty 30.
I'm gonna go with Amaya. Lyta got last week, I know.
Yes.
But also I feel like she got a lot to do this past episode, you know, like you mentioned before, she got to inspire her daughter and tell her that it's okay to have doubts and still be a good leader for your village, and she just tried to save her village, and I think that that's something that she's been struggling with the entire season, so I think that...
And she succeeded!
Yes!
I do think that in advocation for Amaya that this is the first time that she's really been proactive about her destiny because she's been running away from it all season.
Yes.
And so I think that's something that's good for her, that she, this was the episode where she became proactive and decided to do something to make the situation better for her daughter and her granddaughters.
Yay, Amaya! Woo-hoo! Okay, so with Amaya crowned as a Lady of Gumption of the Week, that is all we have for you. So please send us your feedback. Let us know if you agree with our Steven problems this week. Or if you disagree, give us a dissertation on why with photo evidence. And let us know what you think about Krypton. Do you think that we should do full recaps of it? Or mini recaps like we have been doing? Or nothing? And just shut up about Krypton.
And a reminder, Flash is back next week. So tune in and we will go back to talking about that. And if you do want Krypton, know that our podcast will be even longer.
Or we'll be like two podcasts. We'll see. We'll see what happens. All right. Thank you for listening and goodbye.